Good afternoon, everyone. The Health and Human Services Finance Division is called to order. Welcome, everybody. We've got quite a full room. We're excited today to be hearing some very good bills, interesting bills on pharmaceutical prices. I know a lot of you are excited and interested in that topic. Just for members, and if you're for those who aren't, if you're talk to one of your colleagues who comes in later and they didn't hear this announcement, because we are going to recess the committee after our regular time and come back this evening, please put the bills that we haven't heard back in your folder so that staff doesn't have to run around and make new copies and, okay, just, you know, to help make things simpler. So please make sure everybody knows that as they come into the room. Also, before we get started with the first bill, I would like to acknowledge we have some visitors, 12th grade students from Champlin Park High School, an AP student group. Where are you, folks? Raise your hands. All right. Great. Well, welcome. We're glad to have you here today to participate. We'll watch anyway and see how we do things here. I do want to tell the audience, especially because we have students, when we hear testimony in committee, we don't applaud or make comments from the audience, with the exception of what we just did, okay? So I just want to lay that out for folks. We just and we have a heavy agenda, so we want to be able to move through the agenda as quickly as we can. So we do have a quorum. So the first order of business would be to ask for a motion to approve the minutes of March 21st. Is there Representative Bierman moves to approve the minutes of March 21st, 2019. Is there any discussion to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Thank you very much. Okay. So, members, you have, I think, have been given some information from the Department of Health. We had hoped to have sort of a brief overview before we began hearing our pharmaceutical-related bills, just kind of about this issue. So the Department of Health has given us some information, and what they say is that $33.4 billion, were spent on prescription drugs from 2009 to 2013. So just think about that for a few minutes. It's a lot of money. And I won't read through the rest of the information, but as we think about how to control costs in healthcare, which is a big topic, pharmaceutical spending is a big piece of that, and we all know, and I'm sure you're going to hear from a lot of our testifiers about how drug prices have really skyrocketed, and this is a real concern across all Minnesota for people, both those who have insurance and those who have private insurance, employer-based insurance, those who are on public programs. It's a cost. It's a real concern across the board to make sure that people get the prescriptions they need without going broke in the process. So we're going to start with Representative Mann's bill. So Representative Mann is going to move House File 728 that it be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Finance Omnibus Bill. So Representative Mann, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, members. So today we're going to talk about, starting off with House File 728, which deals with the PBMs, or the pharmacy benefit managers, their licensure and transparency. I have a couple of amendments offered. Should I move those now, Madam Chair?
If you would like, Representative Mann.
Thank you. I don't have them with me, so I don't know what they're numbered.
Oh. Okay, well, there are three.
Thank you.
We have three amendments in the packet. Can someone provide those?
I have two of them.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative
Thank
Hamilton.
Thank you. So the A19-0263.
Okay. And Representative Mann, are the other amendments yours as well?
Yeah.
Did you want to put them on all before we discuss the bill?
Yeah.
Okay. So Representative Mann moves the A190263 bill to get amendment to get the bill in the order in which she would like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The amendment is adopted.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then the H0728A9
okay,
and the A10.
All right. Well, we have to do them one at a time. Representative Mann is moving the A9 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The A9 is adopted. And the A10, Representative Mann is moving the A10 amendment.
Yes, Madam Chair.
To get the bill in the shape in which she'd like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion is approved.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the three amendments offered today, one will allow PBMs to request waivers if they can't meet a network service area, so we don't jeopardize service to rural areas. The next one does not allow for PBMs to discriminate against 340B pharmacies, which they have been doing, and there should be a handout in your packet regarding that. And the last one simply states that the mail order pharmacies that the PBMs frequently use have to provide medications in a timely manner. So I have spent the last 12 years now of my life watching drug prices increase and watching patients struggle more and more to get their medications. I have also watched the encroachment of the PBM on the physician-patient relationship as well as the pharmacist-patient relationship. PBMs function as middlemen in a already pretty complex healthcare system. They once had a role in processing prescriptions and negotiating for the lowest drug costs. However, this role has slowly expanded to work with large payers with the promise to continue to negotiate for the lowest cost. Instead, what has happened is that they position themselves in a very lucrative space, and they begin using that position as a gatekeeper between the manufacturer and what ultimately gets to the patient, and requiring kickbacks and rebates from the manufacturer in order to place their medications on a formulary that ultimately gets to the patient. And this is just one of the things that they do to maximize their profit. We know that PBMs currently take home $10 billion per year, and that almost 80% of that market is dominated between three companies. And it's pretty remarkable that we allow such a huge player in our healthcare system to operate with such obscurity and without any transparency. And most importantly, aside from the fact that the PBMs are actually siphoning money out of our healthcare system and pushing that cost to the patient, is that the PBMs are making very big medical decisions with real-life consequences, where patients end up in the emergency department or hospitalized when drug formularies change without warning. Iowa is currently debating removing PBMs from their county employee drug programs after they found that they were paying the PBMs thousands of dollars per month extra just for their county jail programs. West Virginia did remove the PBMs from their MA programs in July of 2017 and ended up saving $38 million. So what this bill does is it licenses PBMs and requires their complete transparency in their dealings so that we get a better idea of where our money is going. And that's kind of the overview of the bill. I think we have some testifiers, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Mann. So let's see. We have several testifiers who signed up to testify. First, we have, okay, let me take them in the order that they're on here. Okay, so Randy Schindler. After Randy Schindler is going to be Sarah Greenfield, then David Root, then Bentley Graves. Welcome to the committee.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I assume you can hear me okay?
Yeah, please say your name and your affiliation for the record.
Randy Schindler. I'm the Chief Financial Officer of A-Strip Companies.
Please go ahead.
Our company operates 17 retail pharmacies and 4 long-term care pharmacies and a specialty infusion pharmacy. We have locations throughout central and southern Minnesota. In total, we employ 499 people, many of which live and work in rural communities. Sterling was founded in 1952. Our founder, Leonard Astrup, started his first store in Austin, Minnesota. He ended up building a legacy. His sons continue to grow the business, and today I work with Leonard's grandchildren. three generations in total. Leonard's legacy is at risk, however. Times have changed. Our industry has become so complicated with so many entities involved, including pharmacy benefit managers, that make it increasingly difficult for our independent business to survive. I've spent 26 years working with successful family-owned businesses, but never in my professional life have I seen such dramatic industry change as I have in my 6 years working in the pharmacy space with A-Strip companies. I am by no means a healthcare expert, but the negative financial impact that PBMs have had on our family-owned business is staggering. I'm here today in support of House File number 728. I've testified previously, as have others, about the merits of this bill. We need to, as consumers, patients, and as a state, we need to shed some much-needed light on the day-to-day business practices that PBMs engage in. We need to have reporting to plan sponsors and to the Commissioner of Commerce. We need to ask PBMs to be licensed, just like physicians, pharmacists, carriers, and every other actor in the healthcare delivery ecosystem. We need to stop gag clauses, copay clawbacks, opaque spread pricing, rebates, and formulary gains. We've seen other states investigate and attempt to uncover exactly what's happening under the hood, and I'm glad that Minnesota will begin to peel back this onion. I said before that this is complex, but it doesn't have to be. Operate in the open, deal fairly, and let consumers know what's happening. I do believe that PBMs were started to do good and to contain costs. However, today that's not happening. They need scrutiny and visibility to ensure the claim processing industry has fair rules of the road, and most importantly, to ensure the patient care is the primary focus. Thank you for this opportunity to speak with you today. I'll stand by for your questions.
Thank you very much. And you know what I think what we'll do is, members on each of these bills, if the testifiers could just stay around in case there are questions, we'll get through the testifiers and then we'll see if members have questions. So members, please make note of your questions and we'll let the testifiers get through.
Yeah. Thank you.
And Sarah Greenfield, and also members, we are going to ask testifiers to please limit your testimony to 2 minutes if you can, and we hate to ask people to do that, but we have a very heavy agenda today. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Greenfield.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Sarah Greenfield. I'm here on behalf of Take Action Minnesota. We have 55,000 members in every county in the state and 22 member organizations, all working together for greater social, racial, and economic justice. PBMs add a layer of complexity and confusion to our healthcare system, making it harder to determine who is getting a deal and who is paying for it. They have managed to remain largely unregulated while becoming one of the biggest players in healthcare delivery. A company that the enrollee may never have even heard of has a major role in deciding the drugs that will be in their formulary and how much they will pay for them. No one really knows how many of the deals that PBMs cut with drug manufacturers get passed on to the health plans, much less the people who enroll in those plans. Not the enrollee, not the insurer, not the government. We especially need oversight of PBMs because it can be in the PBM's best interest to promote expensive drugs that they can make a lot of money on, even if those aren't the best deals for patients and insurers. We need our government to take responsible action. Take Action Minnesota strongly supports this effort to introduce common sense regulations to PBMs in Minnesota, including transparency, oversight, and giving the PBMs fiduciary responsibility to the plans that contract with them. Without that important addition, PBMs are most responsible to make profits for their shareholders, and Minnesota families can't afford that added cost for the medicines we rely on to live and thrive. We ask you to please support House File 728.
Thank you very much for your testimony. David Root. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is David Root. I represent Prime Therapeutics. We are a Minnesota-based PBM. We are the PBM for Minnesota Blue Cross Blue Shield. We are a slightly different organization as far as PBMs go. We are actually owned by 18 not-for-profit Blue Cross Blue Shield plans, of which Minnesota Blue is one. Basically, we have a number of sections with respect to the bill that we have some concerns over. We would welcome the opportunity to sit down and discuss those sections with the author and perhaps be able to mitigate some of the what we believe to be unintended consequences. I'll be around to take questions.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Root. Bentley Graves? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bentley Graves with the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thank you for the opportunity to testify this afternoon. I wanted to highlight concerns that we have with two of the sections of the bill. This bill does a number of things from synchronization to substitution to gag clauses to increasing transparency and reporting. Our concerns are limited to Sections 4 and Section 7. The Section 4 has to do with imposing a fiduciary requirement on PBMs. And while I certainly understand from the author's perspective and from the discussion around this bill over the last several weeks, the intent to ensure that PBMs are acting in the best interest of the plan sponsors, that particular approach comes with it what we believe are to be some unintended consequences that we have concerns would raise the costs of those arrangements, of those agreements for plan sponsors. This is something that the FTC, among others, has looked at it and has come to the same conclusion. We've had some conversation with the author about that and look forward to continue to work with her on that. I think that there is a way to move forward some language to get at the underlying intent without maybe triggering some of those unintended consequences. And then the other issues we have around Section 7 that would significantly restrict the use of tools like mail order pharmacy or especially pharmacies in which the PBMs may have an ownership interest. And there again, these are tools that are leveraged by the plan sponsors to help not just reduce costs for themselves and for enrollees, but also improve adherence. There's a number of studies and data out there that shows that these tools should do just that. And so, again, we believe that there are ways to work around the language and get at the intent of leveling the playing field without triggering some of these unintended consequences. And we sort of look forward to having the opportunity to continue that conversation with Representative Mann. So thank you very much for the opportunity.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience who wishes to testify on House File 728? Okay, I'm not seeing anybody. Member questions. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mann, thanks for bringing this bill forward. There's some great pieces of this bill that I really like, especially lifting the gag order so that we can have more price transparency and allowing consumers to make informed decisions. I was reading through the bill, and I apologize that I didn't read in detail before the meeting, but could you explain to me in the bill where it talks about network adequacy? I'm trying to make sure that we don't inadvertently raise the cost of prescription drugs because we're putting some mandates on PBMs. And I know in the healthcare world for hospitals, when we talk about network adequacy, we're kind of forcing them to negotiate with doctors to bring them into the network, and sometimes that raises the cost of care for the reimbursement rates. Can you explain to me in the bill where this is? I see it's in the overview of the House research portion, but if you could explain the mandates for network adequacy.
Madam Chair, Representative, where in the bill is this?
Representative Munson.
I'm just looking at the House research note where it says that the bill establishes requirements for PBMs related to fiduciary and other duties, network adequacy, transparency, and ownership interests. And the network adequacy, or maybe I could ask House research.
Yeah, Mr. Chun.
I found it.
So, Madam Chair, Representative Munson, the language about network adequacy is in Section 5 of the bill.
Okay. If everybody wants to go ahead and locate that.
Page 7.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. So it just says that the PBM has to have an adequate pharmacy network to provide access with a reasonable distance from the enrollee. This is not a very radical idea. Like you said, every aspect of the healthcare system does this. And actually, our amendment today makes sure that PBMs can apply for waivers if they are not able to meet that standard so that we don't have that unintended consequence.
Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think in the age of mail order pharmaceuticals. I don't know how much the geographic requirement for making sure that there's a pharmacy within a certain mileage of someone or time distance of someone would be as important, but that was one of the concerns I had wanted to ask about when reading the summary of the bill. So thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you also to Representative Mann for bringing this bill forward. It looks like a good, very good start on something that could be very beneficial to all consumers in Minnesota. First question is, Representative Mann, do doctors have any input with PBMs on drug selections for formularies?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, no. So this is actually one of the big pieces that the PBMs kind of encroach in that patient-doctor relationship, and they start to make choices for the physician and for the patient as far as what medicines they can be on. So, for example, I can put you on a depression medication or a high blood pressure medication, and at any point in time, you can get a note back from the PBM and from the insurance company saying that that medicine is no longer covered and that you have to be on something completely different, despite the fact that you may have been on that medication for the last 10 years of your life. And so that increases healthcare costs, because now we have to start over. You have to come in for testing, and that may include blood testing. That may include rechecking your blood pressure. We need to discuss new side effects that you may be having. So that's actually a big problem with the PBMs.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Mann, on that count, as far as drugs that are still available, they take them off the market or out of their formulary, and then you have to scramble to find something else. And they will not listen to your recommendation that this drug has been effective, and you have no recourse, none whatsoever.
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, for the most part, that's correct. So generally, they'll give you a list of, say, two or three medications that you have to work from. And you will have to go through all of the medications on that list before you can go back to them and say, none of these worked. Can we please, please have the medication they were originally on?
Thank you. Madam Chair, just one more question. So what is their reasoning to take successful drugs off the market, do you think?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair. So generally what happens is a PBM will deal with the manufacturer, and the PBM will say, if you want drugs X, Y, and Z on this formulary that the patient has access to, we need a kickback or a rebate. So sometimes that rebate is just a flat fee. Sometimes it's a percentage of what the medicine costs. So if we're, and it's a constant negotiation. And if the next time we meet, the manufacturers give them a bigger rebate for a different drug, they'll put that new drug on the formulary and kick out the old one.
So, Madam Chair and Representative Mann, it's a financial decision.
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, yes.
I have more questions, but I'll give some more people an opportunity.
Okay, well, thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, I like parts of this bill also, Representative Mann. Obviously, there's been some problems. We had presentations in the past with PBMs, either owning a pharmacy or, you know, using the rebate system for their advantage versus what's good for the patient or ignoring the doctor. But I would have a question for Mr. Graves from the Minnesota Chamber.
Okay, if Mr. Graves could come back, please. Go ahead, Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, Mr. Graves, you said Section 4 and Section 7, you have concerns about it would actually raise the cost of prescription drugs. Could you expand a little bit on that for members to understand exactly where why you believe that?
Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Greening. Yes, so Section 4, as I mentioned, would require a PBM to act as a fiduciary. And again, that terminology, that requirement will come with a very specific legal requirements and liability requirements that typically don't fit the relationship between a PBM and a plan sponsor. And while that is certainly something that a plan sponsor can ask a PBM to do, or in certain circumstances can apply to the contract, this blanket requirement, we have concerns, and again, has been found by folks like the FTC, would impose requirements on these contractual relationships that don't necessarily fit in, and would limit the ways that a PBM and a plan sponsor can establish their contractual requirements and would impose costs on that, and also could end up limiting some of the cost-saving tools that that plan sponsors depend upon PBM's employee on their behalf to lower costs and for themselves and for their enrollees.
Representative Brenhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. So do you have alternative language, or are you...
We do, yes. We have we've worked with... Madam Chair, Representative Brenhagen, we do. We've been able to work on this in the other body with the author there, and I was able to get that language to Representative Mann, but it wasn't until just last night. So, I mean, I understand that was kind of short notice, but it is something that we, you know, would look forward to exploring further with her.
And one more, Representative Grenhagen.
Yeah, Section 7, he also referenced, Madam Chair. Just wanted to see if he'd expand on why he believes that will drive
across. Mr. Graves.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Grenhagen. And the concern there is the kind of the blanket prohibition on the use by a health plan or a plan sponsor on a mail order or a specialty pharmacy or some other outlet that the PBM may have an ownership interest in. And here, again, is something that has been looked at in a number of different ways at a number of different times, and it has been pretty conclusively shown to lower costs for the plan sponsors as an outlet. It's also something that, you know, in the fiscal note is raised as a concern on behalf of CGIP, that taking this away as a tool may well bring with it cost increases.
Okay. How about we give Representative Mann a chance to respond if you'd like. Do you want to respond to any of those points?
Sure.
Before we do that, are you finished with asking Mr. Graves questions?
Just one more quick follow-up, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, let's finish this, and then we'll go to
Representative Graves or Mr. Graves. So do you have alternative language for Section 7 also?
Mr. Graves.
Madam Chair, Representative Green, we do. This is another section that we've been working on for the last several weeks as well.
Okay.
All right. So thank you, Mr. Graves. So Representative Mann, did you want to, I don't know if you want to comment, respond to any of that, and then we'll go on to
thank
more
you,
member
Madam
questions.
Chair. So Section 4, I mean, we are asking PBMs, instead of acting in the benefit of their shareholders, to act in the benefit of the people that they're serving. And I don't see how anyone here could have a problem with that. It's pretty straightforward. And lastly, Section 7 is just saying that a lot of PBMs have monopolies on the chain, right? There's the PBM, they own the mail-in pharmacy or the specialty pharmacy, and what they do is they pay them more since they're paying themselves, and then they shortchange other pharmacies. So unless you're owned by them, you're getting paid less. So we're saying that cannot happen anymore in Section 7.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mann. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just, I guess, for the committee, unless the Mr. Graves wants to come back up, I just was questioning the Section 7 where he indicated that there is significant evidence that prices will drop under this ownership structure where pharmaceuticals or the PBMs can own buildings and pharmacies. I'd be interested to see some evidence of that because we don't see it in a lot of things like asthma inhalers, et cetera. So I would be interested if he would provide data on that. And then also, I wasn't convinced yet on the fiduciary statement that he mentioned as far as that being also could potentially increase costs. We went through that in the financial segment. That was proven that we can live with fiduciary responsibilities. And I don't think that it would restrain freedom. So if there's evidence that he has on that as well, I'd be interested to see it.
All right. Well, I hope he can provide some of that offline, perhaps. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess the Section 4 that discusses the fiduciary duty, it has some concerns. I was wondering why you're writing legislation that requires a pharmacy benefit manager to have a fiduciary duty to a health carrier or health insurance company or health plan, and why shouldn't the pharmacy benefit manager have a fiduciary duty to protect the patient? Is that this is what we're really talking about here, is the cost of health care. And you're having one corporation giving them the fiduciary duty to protect the bottom line of another corporation. Why not the consumer? Where's the patient in all of this?
Yeah, Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson. So the PBM doesn't work for the patient directly, right? So they don't have a contract between them. If we're saying that the PBM needs to have a fiduciary responsibility to the carrier, it is in the carrier's best interest to have the lowest pharmaceutical cost to the patient, because then they save money also, because it's coming out of their pocket as well. So if we make sure that that relationship is stable and that the PBMs are working for the carriers and not their shareholders, that should substantially bring down the cost in general.
Yeah, Representative Mann, thank you. And Representative Munson, quick follow-up?
It's just a follow-up. I mean, if you're having the pharmacy benefit manager protecting the bottom line of the insurance plan, then you would think that they would be doing something that would make it more profitable for the insurance plan, either by denying benefits or changing the prescriptions around to be more profitable versus actually doing what's right by the patient. That's why I just have concern about that fiduciary duty being in there in a corporation-to-corporation relationship or corp-to-corp or business-to-business relationship. Mm-hmm. So that seems concerning to me. But I guess I'll leave it at that.
Okay. And I would just say, Representative Munson, recall that premiums are regulated. Insurance companies are regulated, and their rates have to be approved. And we also have this thing called a medical loss ratio, which requires them to spend a certain portion of their income, of their receipts, on actual health care. So, you know, there is that, although I do understand where you're going with your question. Representative Haley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to the first question to the author, how many PBMs operate in Minnesota?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, there's about 40 of them.
Did you say 40 or four?
Mm-hmm. 40.
Okay.
Representative Haley.
And most of the market is controlled by how many of those?
Three.
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair.
Representative Haley. And Representative Haley, and I don't know how long you're going to do the kind of question response, but we're going to, if you could... We're going to try to wrap it up soon on this bill, but go ahead, please.
What I wanted to know is if the PBMs at all have come forward with recommendations on licensing language. There are parts of the bill that are really good and I support, and then parts that I have concerns about. And the licensing part, we've done this with other aspects of healthcare. Spent a number of years working with the home and care and assisted living to kind of bring peace in the valley and bring all the stakeholders together. So I wanted to know if you'd worked with at least the major players in Minnesota, the top three PBMs, and if they've come forth with recommendations regarding the licensing.
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative, so I've talked to the three of them, as well as some smaller ones, and none of them, as far as I know, have any issues with the licensing piece.
Okay, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, can I ask a question to the PBM?
I'll give you one more, Representative Haley. Go ahead.
I think that would be Mr. Root, if he could come forward.
Welcome back, Mr. Root.
Thank you.
Representative Haley.
Madam Chair and Mr. Root, if you could briefly just comment from a PBM's perspective how you set formularies and how a patient would go about access to a drug that may be off formulary.
Sure. We use P&T, Madam Chair, we use what they call P&T committees. Those are pharmacy and therapeutic committees. Those are made up of the top practitioners, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, university personnel, researchers, professional researchers that are in tune with the most cutting edge aspects of drug research. We use them to look at clinical efficacy, disruption to utilization, disruption to the member, and we make a recommendation to the health plan as to what drugs should be on the formulary and roughly where they should be. In Minnesota, if an individual is on a particular therapy and they have been on that therapy and there is a medical necessity that can be shown, that they need to continue on that therapy should the drug be rotated on the formulary. Our plan has a medical exceptions process by which the doctor can illustrate the medical necessity for the consumer or the patient, and the patient can stay on that product in a covered fashion.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Root. Okay. Representative Grunhagen, you said you had a very short comment because you've already spoken. Go ahead.
And it's for Mr. Root. Madam Chair.
All right.
Okay. say, you know, we've had some pretty damning testimony regarding PBMs in this in this committee over the last several weeks. And, you know, I could pick out a number of issues, but one is, you know, where a PBM owns a pharmacy and they direct patients to go to their pharmacy and they penalize patients with higher copays or lower reimbursement to if they choose a pharmacy that the PBM doesn't favor or own. It seems like a real bad abuse system for PBMs to be doing that. Do you have any explanation as to why we shouldn't put a stop to that practice?
Mr. Root?
Madam Chair, sure. If you want to, if you're talking about ownership of a mail order facility in the small molecule space, so the normal type run of the mill drugs, the bottom line is that because of the PBM's mail order facility size and the economy that they operate under, they are able to fill that prescription. Typically, an example that you used yourself, sir, is the 90-day supply for a 60-day copay. So two copays, you get a 90-day supply. Again, because of the mail order facility size, we're actually able to fill the and dispense the product cheaper. So we offer that savings to the consumer. The consumer is not required to accept that. The consumer can get their drug at a retail pharmacy if they choose to. But the retail pharmacy is going to charge them for a 90-day supply. They're going to charge them a copay for each 30 days.
Okay. Mr. Root, thank you. Representative Olson gets the last question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I realize this bill has been to Commerce and been to HHS policy, and we're in a finance committee, and so I did peruse the fiscal note, and I'm not seeing a significant piece of our budget here impacted by this, which I think is good. So, Representative Mann, I think what we have in front of us is a bill that has the opportunity to lower costs on health care without a significant cost to what we're looking at in our budget. Would you be willing just to comment on your perspective moving forward, how you could see this impacting Minnesotans' ability to, you know, I just noticing in this fiscal note, too, just even this isn't within the purview of ours, but it's in the purview of our larger general fund budget around impacts for state government employees and others, the opportunity to lower health care costs for others without, and being we're in a finance committee, could you speak to just that portion of what this means within the purview of our budget and what this could do in future years to lower cost of health care in our state?
Representative Mann.
Madam Chair, Representative. So I think this bill has the potential to significantly impact health care costs. And like I've talked about, other states have looked into more PBM transparency and even removing them from the system. And each time this happens, the state saves millions of dollars. And so if we are able to say, you know, show us the books, let's follow the money, which is always the deal, right? And if we can see where the money is going, I think that we can put a stop to some predatory practices that have been happening that we are not aware of because we can't see them. And so overall, now and years from now, having this kind of transparency in these types of transactions is going to be is going to have a very big financial impact for our state.
All right, thank you. Final word, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No question, just a comment. Every one of you have heard my story and how I've been personally impacted by the practices of pharmacy benefits managers, and so I'm going to spare you with those details again. I'm simply going to say this. Representative Mann, thank you so much. You have my full support, and I'll do whatever to help you get this to the desk of the governor. I will roll it there myself if you need me to. So thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. With that, House File 728 is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance omnibus bill. Thank you very much, Representative Mann. Okay, we are going to move on now. We're going to change the order up just a little bit, and we're going to take House File 485, Representative Howard, next. And welcome to the committee, Representative Howard. And I really should have said this at the outset of the first bill that we heard, but we are in the Finance Committee, and these bills that we're hearing, members have had hearings in policy committees as well, as I understand. So while I do want to give members an opportunity to understand what's in the bill, you know, these are bills that have gone through policy committees. Let me just put it that way. So welcome to the committee, Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is House Bill 485, the Alex Smith Emergency Insulin Act. And first, I do have an A1 amendment just with a small technical change.
All right. So first of all, I think I have to move your bill since you're not on the committee.
Yes.
So the chair will move House Bill 485 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Finance Omnibus Bill. And the A1 amendment is your author's amendment to get the bill in the shape in which you'd like to discuss it, Representative Howard?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, so the chair will also move the A1 amendment. All those in favor of the A1, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So go ahead and present your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And what I'd like to do is perhaps invite my testifiers to provide some remarks, and then at that point walk through the bill.
All right. Thank you, Representative Howard. So we have three testifiers on the list, and one of them is ready to go. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair and Representatives, my name is Quinn Nystrom. I've lived with type 1 diabetes for 20 years. My younger brother's had type 1 diabetes for 22 and a half years. Type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. There's nothing that myself, my parents could have done to prevent either one of us from getting type 1 diabetes. They could have put us on a hamster wheel and fed us spinach. We still would have gotten the disease. Ever since we were diagnosed with diabetes, we had to be given insulin from this vial in order to stay alive. If we do not have insulin, we will die quite quickly. It sounds morbid, but that is the truth for somebody living with type 1 diabetes. There's roughly half a million people in Minnesota who live with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. About 5% of people live with type 1 diabetes. People with type 2 diabetes, some people are insulin dependent. It just depends on their case. When I was first diagnosed back in the late 90s, this exact insulin vial, which came out in the late 90s in its current form, was roughly $20. In the last 20 years, this vial, it has not changed in its formulary whatsoever. It has not improved. It has not changed. It has increased 1,200% and now costs me $300. I go through two vials a month minimum. And I'm a single self-employed person on the MinSure system. I'm grateful to be able to have health insurance through our state and to be able to buy insurance with a pre-existing condition. But I do pay $400 a month for health insurance, and then to have to pay also then around $600 for insulin. And I actually, in January, I had to pay the list price for this insulin. And so again, my thing for all of you who are on the committee is, how is somebody who's not making a lot of money, how do they afford to stay alive? We live in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, and you can't afford a medication that was invented back in the 20s. And we have a serious problem when you can go north to Canada, buy the same vial, the same exact vial for $45, or you can go south to Mexico, and you can buy the same exact vial for $45. But here in the United States of America, it has increased to $300. We have a huge problem, and so many people are dying because they're having to ration because they cannot afford this. So I plead with you today that to do something to help the millions of us who are living with diabetes and simply cannot afford their insulin anymore. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Nicole Smith-Holt and James Holt, welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Nicole Smith-Holt, mother of four from Richfield, Minnesota. I'm a MAPE member. I am an Insulin for All advocate, and I am a charity ambassador for T1 International. I'm here today because in 2017, my son Alex Smith, age 26, died. He was a type 1 diabetic, and he died from DKA, which is diabetic ketoacidosis. This is a complication of diabetes, and it occurs when the body is starved from insulin. He died because he could not afford the current list price for his life. I received a call at 5:20 p.m. on June 27th that my son's body was found in his apartment. I will never forget receiving that call. I will never forget how it feels to have your heart crushed by a few words. No one prepares a parent for hearing the words, "I'm sorry, ma'am, but your son is dead." No parent deserves to suffer the pain that I have experienced. No parent should have to agonize over planning a funeral for their child. Alec had his entire life ahead of him. He is gone far too soon. He was a hard-working young man who had so many dreams and ambitions. He was goofy, loving, shy but outspoken. He loved sports teams, all of Minnesota sports teams, and he loved outdoor activities. Alec had a true zest for life, and I miss him so very much. Prior to 1922, type 1 diabetes was a certain death sentence. There was no treatment. Since 1923, there has been several advancements on the production of insulin. The most recent version has been around since 1996. That's that vial right there. Since 1996, the list price has increased over 1,200%, making the treatment unbearable and unaffordable for far too many. I hear daily horrific stories of how people are making grave sacrifices to afford their insulin, how people are buying expired insulin from the black market, rationing their insulin, starving themselves, sharing with friends and family. And this is just a small list. There's so many more. Type 1 diabetics are experiencing a crisis. Affordable insulin is a right to life, and this needs to be addressed. We need to find as many ways possible to prevent as many deaths as we can. So insulin has increased by 1,200% in 20 years. But I ask you, if gas, electricity, or water had increased by this amount, would it be considered a national emergency? Probably. But insulin is not considered that. People are losing their lives because there are no regulations in place to protect them from the massive increases. Nothing gets done. More lives are lost, and our government just stands by and does nothing. This seems wrong to me. Alec should still be alive. Alec would be alive if the state of Minnesota had the Alec Smith Emergency Insulin Act in place in 2017. This is a safety net bill that has the ability to save as many lives. Far too many people find themselves in situations where this program could have been utilized. I ask you to please vote yes for the Alec Smith Emergency Insulin Act. I ask that you vote yes for life. Vote yes for all type 1s who find themselves in a situation where they don't know if next month they'll be homeless or dead because they couldn't afford their rent and insulin. Vote yes for every type 1 who is forced to use the black market to buy expired insulin or insulin that has been tampered with because they just don't know where it came from. Vote yes for all of those who've had to start a crowdfunding campaign to raise money to afford insulin, begging strangers for financial help to stay alive for just one more month. Vote yes for all the parents of type 1s who are worried nonstop about their babies. Vote yes for Alec. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Mr. Holt, did you want to say a few words, too?
Yes.
Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. Hello, my name is James Holt, Jr. I'm the father of four, live in Ridgefield, Minnesota. I am a Fairview Southdale employee, a SEIU healthcare board member. As all of you heard from my wife, our son, Alex Smith, died at age 26, all because he could not afford his insulin. Alex's not the only person who has recently died from rationing insulin. We have heard from far too many people all across the U.S. have lost their loved ones as well. You won't hear these stories from people who live in other countries. Only the U.S., because here in the U.S., pharma has the ability to charge as much as they want to for their product. For example, Alec used Humalog and Lantus. These two types of insulin here in the U.S. retail for around $1,000. But if you travel outside the U.S., you would be looking at a retail price of less than $100. As a parent, I have always tried to teach my children that if they were wrong, the best thing that they can do is to come clean and admit it. When you have screwed up, take responsibility and learn from your mistake. But we have heard countless times from pharma that everyone else in the supply chain that is responsible for the price of life-saving medicine increases. They point the finger at PBMs, the insurance industry, and even physicians. When are we going to man up and accept the responsibility for this crisis that they have helped create? They will tell you that no one actually pays the list price, so it is okay to charge crazy amounts for their product. Truth is, 44 million Americans do not have health care insurance, and another 38 million do not have adequate insurance. Millions more with high deductible insurance plans where they're paying list price as well until they meet their deductibles, which can be upwards of $10,000 or more. List price affordability matters. Pharma wants us all to focus on average patients. I want to focus on marginalizing patients, those paying list price. Net pricing means little to many Americans who are paying list price for one reason or another. Rebates, coupons, discounts do not apply to those less fortunate who are paying cash at the counter. Pharma has always talked about how insurance companies need to be reformed. I agree, but those type of reform are years away from reality. The Alex Smith Emergency Act is a safety net for those type ones in Minnesota who are in an emergency situation that could be helped rapidly. Many will say, well, if it's an emergency, they can go to the emergency room for help. The thing about the emergency room is very expensive, and a type 1 needs multiple insulin injections per day to stay alive. Should we accept a type 1 to live in the emergency room until there's more appropriate solutions? Pharma is always going to tell you all about the great patient assistance program that the three makers offer. Well, one thing, the only reason they need these programs is because insulin is not affordable. And second thing is, very few people even qualify for these assistance programs. They, in my opinion, make it very difficult to apply for and to be approved. I have asked far too many people if they ever tried, and all but one told me that they were denied. Alec was denied because he made $40,000 a year before taxes. He was not wealthy. $40,000 is not a lot of money. I ask you all, please vote yes today. Make sure Alec Death was the last one here in Minnesota. Make his life and his death mean something here. Please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Holt. Christina Moorhead. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. My name is Christina Moorhead, and I'm a Senior Director of State Policy for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. PhRMA is the trade association representing the country's leading innovative biopharmaceutical research companies that have invested more than $600 billion since 2000 in the search for new life-saving and life-improving treatments and cures. So to begin today, I wanted to provide some context on the challenges that patients are facing. So we've heard challenges of patients affording their medicines, and then we've heard about list prices. So I do just want to touch on that briefly. Last year, we saw spending on medicines grow just 0.6%, and net prices grew just 1.5%, according to data from IQVIA. This growth is less than overall inflation. The slowdown is due in part to the discounts that our manufacturers supply to payers that are increasing. Our companies on average rebate 40 cents of every dollar spent on a medicine back to the supply chain and other entities. Pharmacy benefit managers, insurers, and hospitals are getting billions of dollars every year from these discounts or from programs like 340B. These rebates totaled more than $150 billion just last year. However, instead of using these savings to lower what patients pay for medicines, those funds are often used to pad their bottom lines, to lower premiums, or to fill other holes in their budgets. And the insulin market is a good example of how these rebates and discounts are not benefiting patients. Negotiated discounts, rebates, and other price concessions can lower the list price of insulin by 70% or more, and have kept net prices flat to declining in recent years. However, payers are increasingly including these medicines in high-deductible plans, and they're subjecting them to coinsurance, which exposes these patients to undiscounted list prices, even when the insurer may negotiate a large rebate. So as you can see, the incentives in the system are misaligned, and they're not benefiting patients. We think that patients deserve to be treated with fairness, and we need to address the ways medicines are paid for, including making sure that patients are benefiting from these discounts and rebates. A well-intended House File 485 does not address the issue of what a patient is paying for a prescription medicine. It ignores the reality that health insurers are determining the price a patient pays out of pocket for a prescription medicine. Additionally, this bill lacks many details. What is the annual cost of this program? How many Minnesotans will be served by this program? How will the program increase costs in other ways, possibly for other insured patients? How much will pharmacies be reimbursed? How much will the assistance program cost for the state administratively? Will the assistance count toward the patient's deductible if he or she has a high deductible plan? What will the co-payments be for individuals as required under Section 7, Subdivision 3 of the bill? And what happens to the patient after the 90 days expire and the patient is no longer eligible for the program? Instead, PhRMA encourages the committee to look at policy solutions that will immediately help patients with their costs, including sharing these discounts with patients. And as we've provided today, there are all of our manufacturers with insulin products provide assistance programs, and we've provided you that information. So in closing, we appreciate and applaud the commitment of the committee to address the high out-of-pocket costs that diabetes patients face when paying for their medicines, but we believe this legislation falls short in addressing the issues of why patients have high out-of-pocket costs.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on House File 485? All right. Did you want to come down and testify? Okay. Welcome. Please just give us your name if you have an affiliation, and go ahead.
Hi,
my name is 2 minutes, if you would.
Okay. Yeah. My name is Sarah Ginsburg, Madam Chair and members of the committee. When I was younger, I felt very sick, and my mom took me to the doctor, and I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes. My first shot of insulin was like magic. I felt right away better. I've only been thankful for insulin since that day. I've never minded taking shots. This summer, I will have been diagnosed for 50 years in living with diabetes, and I feel nothing but thankful. When I was younger, my parents made me responsible to pick up my insulin. I rode my bike to town drug, charged $20 to my parents' account, rode my bike back, and put the insulin in the fridge. When I was in college, I paid for my own insulin. I was on several shots a day. It was called insulin therapy. I took a shot 20 minutes before I ate. The goal was for insulin to meet up with my food and maintain my sugar level. I tried not to eat so I wouldn't have to use my insulin. I rationed my insulin too. Sometimes I had to borrow money. I waited until the very last minute to borrow or to buy. Both had their own downfalls. I carried a bottle of insulin and syringe in my purse. It is especially difficult in Minnesota to carry insulin around. Insulin can't get too warm. It cannot get too cold. It's very temperature sensitive. And the little insulin bottles break easily. They roll around, which can break, and they break, and it brings on a large extra expense. When I was newly married, I picked up my insulin at Target. I went expecting the price, but still, I would break down and cry when I got in my car. When our second son was born, he was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes when he was almost 2 years old. The expense of two type 1 diabetics was overwhelming for me.
Ms. Gifford, I'm sorry, I have to ask you to please wrap it up.
Okay. With that being said, the price was criminal, and I felt that. And I am, as a nurse, I know that the prices of medication get less expensive, and all medications except one that I know of have several generics. I'm here to support the Alex Holt Emergency Insulin Fund, and I'm hoping that you will prioritize it. My son Joshua turns 26 this summer, and it's a very big concern for not him, but everybody. So, thank you. Thank you for hearing me.
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony. We have quite a list of members who have questions. And go ahead, Representative Howard, you want to say something?
Madam Chair, I'm wondering if I could just spend a couple minutes just to walk through the bill. I haven't done that yet.
Okay. And Representative Howard, since this is a fiscal committee, we don't have a fiscal note in our packets. And I want to give Mr. Berg, before we actually walk through the bill, and I know members have had a chance to look at it, in addition to listening to the testimony. So I think we could keep that very brief, but I do want Mr. Berg to mention what's going on with the fiscal note, if we could do that. Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, members, there is a preliminary fiscal note. It is not quite signed off on, but just within the last hour or so, some information has gone in. It basically shows about $280,000 a year in costs to implement this, and then that the fee would raise approximately $10.4 million a year, which would then be used to purchase the invoice. That probably will be signed off on before our evening session. I can distribute it if it is.
Okay. Did everybody understood that? Okay. All right. So, Representative Howard, I'm going to go to you to walk through, but then I have, just so members know, and we were really hoping to do one more bill in this time, and then we're going to come back at 5:30. We have Munson, Cantrell, Halverson, Schumacher, Kunish, Padin, Grunhagen, Hamilton, and Zerwa. So we're going to let each member ask one question, please. We're not going to let, but anyway, Representative Howard, first to you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'll try to be brief. And, the premise of this bill is never again. Never again should someone lose their life in the state because they can't afford the insulin they need to survive. And we are really narrowly tailoring this and focusing on the Minnesotans that we feel are in really the gravest danger, folks like Alec that were earning enough money so that they were not eligible for public programs, but not earning so much money that they're able to afford the crushing cost of insulin. Just for your frame of reference, we're looking at an individual earning between about $25,000 and $50,000 a year in terms of the income scale. The assistance program would be something administered by DHS, who we've worked closely with on the bill. A qualified individual would submit a very basic statement of financial need, and through that receive a coupon card of sorts to allow them to fill a 90-day supply of insulin. This is meant to be emergency supply and really focus that as a short-term solution, but we do know that this is a reality, a challenge long-term for folks. That's why we do in addition to the emergency program, have language in this bill that would direct the Board of Pharmacy to be providing more information to our pharmacists so that they can be providing better information to help our patients find access to the kinds of care or programs or services, and also to create a public website to do the same. I think that information can be power for patients, and so that's a part of this challenge as well in terms of connecting Minnesotans to resources. This bill is funded through the creation of an insulin registration fee. They would ask the large drug manufacturers of insulin to share in the solution of a crisis that they helped create. And just for your frame of reference, there are three manufacturers of insulin that basically control the entire market, which I think speaks to some of the why we've seen the prices skyrocket. That is who would be asked to participate in this fee. And I just have to mention, there's several questions posed by Big Pharma to us about the bill, and we can get into some of those questions. But my question back is, when will Big Pharma take one shred of accountability for solving this crisis? That's my question back. And one of the questions was, what happens after the 90-day supply when someone can't afford their insulin? It's incredible to me that would be a question for Big Pharma. You know what's going to happen is people are going to struggle to afford their insulin. And there's a lot of bills here that we're looking at to address this, but I just had to comment on that. And that is the question back to Big Pharma. When are you going to acknowledge that you are responsible for being part of the solution? So I just had to say that. And lastly, I do want to be clear again that this is a short-term solution. It's a stopgap in a broken healthcare system. It's not a solve-all. This bill doesn't say that it's a solution to the crisis we're facing, but what it does say is that when Minnesotans are dying, we do everything in our power to save them. And, you know, we weren't able to save the life of Alec, but with your support of this bill, Alec will save the lives of Minnesotans, and I really ask for your support. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Howard. Okay. So, again, one brief question, I hope, from each of the many members on the list. I'm sorry, we, these are huge issues. We could talk about them for a very long time. We've had numerous hearings, both in this committee and other committees, and we also have other bills kind of all related. So, Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howard, I'm concerned about this bill because I'm here at the legislature to lower the cost of health care. And I saw the opioid bill come through, which is, again, in tens of millions of dollars in tax on an industry trying to, you know, penalize the pharmaceutical company. And this is a more than $10 million tax on already unaffordable drug that will directly increase the cost for nearly everyone who takes insulin in Minnesota. And it's fueling their reason to increase the cost and pay the government $280,000 to implement it. That's just really concerning. I heard testimony about the $40,000 a year salary of somebody that couldn't afford this. At $48,000, you don't qualify for this program because that's 400% of the poverty level. And I think most of the people earning less than that wouldn't qualify because they'd qualify for Minnesota Care, medical assistance, and all these other exceptions. So I don't know what this is doing other than raising the cost of health care. And the opioid bill that was implemented in New York immediately raised the cost of opioids 1,200%, almost the exact same thing you're fighting here. The penalty for not complying with this, if the pharmaceutical manufacturer thumbs their nose at the Commissioner of Health, they pay a whopping $36,000 in annual fee. So if they don't comply, they just pay $36,000. Do they get to skate off? And how are you going to force them to comply other than just assessing $100 a day? And if they don't comply, do you shut off their supply of insulin to Minnesota, which might be the easiest solution for the manufacturer to just not sell to Minnesota? And what would that do to price? So how are you going to force them to do it? And what do you think that's going to do to the price?
All right. Well, Representative Munson, that's a lot of questions in there, but I do want to just correct one little piece of information. So if you're above 200% of the federal poverty level, you're not eligible for Minnesota Care. You are on the individual market then if you don't have employer insurance, and you're eligible for tax credit, premium tax credit under the Affordable Care Act, but you still have a plan with enormous deductibles that may be completely unaffordable to you. So that is still the person who would be eligible for this. So go ahead.
Madam Chair, Representative Munson, first I speak generally to the point that the argument that Big Pharma always makes, that if you increase their regulation or you ask them to pay, they will raise the price on Minnesotans. They're doing it anyways. They continue to do it. And when you look at the hundreds of millions and these three insulin companies that we're talking about, we're not talking about millions, we're talking about billions of dollars. This is a sliver of those profits. So I fundamentally doubt that this $10 million registration fee will factor significantly into the price. I think we need to look at all kinds of other ways to reduce the price and increase regulation and fight for Minnesotans in the realm of sticking up for Minnesotans. But I don't buy the argument, frankly, that this level of accountability is going to drastically affect the practices that they're already meeting. And just to some of the other questions, I mean, there's a few what-ifs in there. I think we need to move down this path and ask these big pharma companies to be accountable.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Howard, I just wanted to say thank you so much for bringing this bill forward and for all the work that you've done on this bill. I know that it took a lot of labor to get to this point. And to Mr. and Mrs. Smith-Holt, I'm so sorry for your loss. In the year, in 2016, 2018, 2019, we should not have to worry about Minnesotans losing their lives because they cannot afford pharmaceuticals that have been around for decades. That is unacceptable. That is unacceptable. Healthcare is a human right, and no one should have to lose their life. And Mr. Smith-Holt, you gave me a picture of your son. I carry it in my suit coat pocket every day to remind myself that we are fighting for real lives here.
Thank you.
So this bill will go towards saving lives. Representative Howard, thank you so much. Thank you for all the work that you do. And let's make sure that no one else has to lose their life to a treatable illness in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Cantrell. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I take insulin every day, many times a day. I have too much right now, so I had to have a little snack. And having too much insulin in your system and low blood sugar makes you cranky.
You are never cranky, Representative Halverson.
So buckle up. I just had to speak on behalf of all the people that I see in the audience who are here asking us for help, because it frustrates me to no end. I've heard this bill a few times. I'm carrying an insulin bill as well. To hear, as Representative Howard called out, the lack of not just accountability but care for patients that we are hearing from the pharmaceutical companies. To walk into Minnesota and say, we are going to hold your drugs hostage if you ask us to participate in a solution to the fact that Minnesotans cannot get access to medicine. That isn't just life-saving, it's life-giving. It allows us to get up every day and live. Dying of diabetic ketoacidosis is a terrible death, and too many families have had to face that or face the risks of long-term damage to people's bodies. Complications from diabetes kills people. Penny Marshall just died of complications from diabetes. It's a dangerous illness that needs to be managed well, and we all work really, really hard to manage it. And I say, if you have a healthy pancreas and you don't have diabetes, just thank your pancreas, because it works really, really hard. And nobody tells you how hard it is to live with this disease every single day, and the risks that people live with, and the risks of complications that people live with if they don't manage it. So even not just having an emergency situation, but to have poorly managed diabetes puts you at high risk for blindness, for amputation. I walk around super careful of my feet. You guys wouldn't know that on a day-to-day basis, but because I'm at risk, right? And I'm at risk with well-managed, and I'm at risk with a disease that I get to manage because of the good health care that I have. Other people don't have this. And so I guess I just wanted to say, the fact that we have to listen over and over and over again to pharmaceutical companies coming to the table to say why they can't help and be part of the solution frustrates me to no end. The thing that frustrates me even more is we don't even hear we care. Patients aren't hearing we care. Patients aren't being cared for by pharmaceutical companies right now. Stockholders are. Novo Nordisk makes half of their money from the sale of insulin, the insulin that Quinn Nystrom showed us that has gone up 1,200%. This is about profits, pure and simple. We're asking for a tiny way to make sure that at the very least, people don't have to die because of the high price of insulin. And all we would really, I mean, one of the things I just would love to hear someday is we really care about you, patients. And that's all I'm asking, Madam Chair. It's simply a rhetorical question. I'm going back to my snack now. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Halverson. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First question for you. If the fiscal note comes back tonight, we have questions on it. Will there be time to discuss those, or at least get the questions on record?
Yeah, of course, Representative Schumacher.
Okay,
yeah,
thank you, Madam Chair, for that. And to the bill author, just one question on page 5, line 23, when it talks about paying the participating pharmacies. I'm just wondering what the what they're going to be paid on what. It's complicated anyway, so if you could help me with that, that'd be great. Thank you.
Representative Howard.
Madam Chair, from Schumacher, the DHS would provide a coupon card to the patient, and that's would be utilized to make the payment. And I might ask, I might phone a friend for DHS to talk about the reimbursement level, but we worked specifically to make sure that we would be crafting a proposal that would generate buy-in from the pharmacists, that we would make sure that we'd be making them whole with part of this. And so I would just phone a friend.
All right, Mr. Hope, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Chad Hope with DHS, representative. The specific reimbursement rate hasn't been established at this point. It would be envisioned that we'd be contracting with the vendor, as the author has said. Part of that contracting would contemplate what the reimbursement rate would be to those pharmacies. It would be intended that it would be efficient but sufficient to cover the cost of providing that service.
All right. Thank you, Representative Schumacher. Thank you, Mr. Hope.
Thank you.
Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This question is for Ms. Moorhead.
And while she's coming down, let me just say, members, we're not going to try to go to the next bill, but we will be reconvening tonight at 5:30. So go ahead, Representative Kunesh-Podein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Moorhead, you said that there are discounts and rebates on these insulin prescriptions, and that I think you said 40% of the cost goes to the supply chain and the distributors. So 40% goes to those guys, and then there's discounts and rebates. Why can't they just discount and rebate the insulin right off the bat to lower it? And then how is it that 40% of that cost is going to those supply chains and distributors? Is it 40% to the supply chain, then 40% to the distributor? And are we talking about that middleman that's taking that biggest chunk of money?
Ms. Moorhead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, so we said on average, and this will be for all prescription drugs, 40 cents of every dollar for prescription drugs is discounted back to the supply chain. Typically, that is for payers, so that includes government payers like Medicaid, Medicare. It also includes PBMs and health insurers as well. In the insulin market, we see actually that the rebates and discounts are higher. One of our companies released that information this week of net price growth and the rebates for one specific insulin, and we see actually that net prices have decreased over time. And why do why are they offering discounts and rebates to the payers and not directly to the patients? And there are different, I think, reasons for that. In Medicare, in that space, that's actually not allowed. There's a federal rule that's being considered right now because that would be considered a kickback. In Medicaid, it doesn't really matter because the cost of prescription drugs for Medicaid patients is usually 100% covered by the state, possibly with a nominal copayment. In the commercial market, drug manufacturers generally are competing for space on a formulary and for preferred status. And how this has evolved over time is that pharmacy benefit managers who manage most of the prescription drug benefits in the United States have requested higher and higher rebates, and they like it off a higher and higher list price because they make more money on that spread of whatever the list price is versus the net price of the drug. And they have enough influence to also say, if you don't give us that high discount or high rebate, then your drug may not be covered on the formulary. So those are some of the reasons of why you see the economics in the prescription drug world.
Okay, thank you.
Just to comment that Okay. Obviously that's one of the big reasons why this has gone up so much money. Thank you. Yeah,
thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the my comment and question is for Ms. Moorhead also. And you know, I've sold health insurance since 1978. I have a lot of Medicare supplements out there. And what I find is with these excessive costs, and it seems the last decade or so it's really gotten out of control, that a lot of companies offer incentives or even will subsidize those costs for individuals. And I guess I think working with pharma, and, you know, the comment was made, well, the uninsured people have a problem getting affording insulin, but isn't there a way for the bill author to work with pharma to address these needs of the people that are having difficulty accessing that are uninsured and to get a subsidy or free insulin? Because I've seen that in my own practice that, you know, $9,000 a month for one pill for treating a certain type of cancer, and they just can't afford it with the high deductibles, everything else. And yet pharma responds, and they pay very little out of pocket. So is there some way for these uninsured people to coordinate with pharma to get their insulin without setting up a whole government program with an application? I just see the bill as being an inefficient way to meet this need. I just think directly with pharma, somehow it could be worked out a lot better. What are your thoughts?
And yes, universal health care would be a lot more efficient.
No,
Ms. Moorhead.
Madam Chair, they'll have even less access.
We can't applaud. Sorry about that. Ms. Moorhead, go ahead.
We could debate that if you want.
Okay, go ahead.
I wrote a book about it, by the way.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I think thank you for that question. Because we've heard, and I think pharma does care, and I think one of our concerns with this bill is that we see patients in so many different situations, and we see the marketplace has reacted to them in their different situations. And so, yes, I think that there are ways that there are other policy solutions that we can work together to look at, especially chronic care patients who have diabetes. What do they look like when they're covered by Medicaid? What are the problems with that? What do they look like when they're covered by Medicare? What are the issues with that? When they're covered by a high deductible plan and they don't have the $5,000 to spend, what are some policy solutions for that population? If they're uninsured, what's the solution for that population of individuals? If they have a copay-only program, what are some of the problems that some of those individuals face? And we think that that would be a better approach to solving an issue, like how do we get all diabetes patients the medicine that they need? And I think that would be something we'd be very interested in discussing.
Okay, and we're going to go on to, because we have five more minutes in the hearing, and we've got
I just encourage the author to explore that avenue.
Okay.
It would
all
be
right.
More efficient.
Okay.
And you wouldn't be increasing
Thank
the
you,
price.
Representative Grunhagen. Representative Hamilton.
Yes.
Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the bill author. Representative Howard, in Section 7, Subdivision 3 of the bill, line 6.19, you start talking about pharmacy participation. And then in subclause C, you talk about individuals are responsible for paying an insulin copayment to the participating pharmacy. And I'm wondering what that copayment is and where that money would go and what it would be used for.
Representative Howard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I believe we have pegged the copayment to what somebody would pay under Minnesota Care. So I think it's around $25, $20 or $25.
Representative Zerwas, follow-up.
Yeah, just really briefly, Madam Chair, that's the citation here brings you back to the Minnesota Care copay fee schedule. So I'm wondering what happens if someone can't pay that, and then right below that, under 256L, is the portion of that statute that goes to Subdivision 5 in your bill. Subdivision 6 talks about putting liens on people's property and clawing back property if they can't pay copayments or premiums. And so I just want to make sure that we're not then subjecting someone utilizing this process to then go through that, what this legislature has deemed as kind of a punitive process that impacted individuals in greater Minnesota, ag communities, stuff like that.
Representative Howard.
Madam Chair, Representative Zerwas, part of our thinking in crafting this is that when you look at the folks that are eligible to participate, you know, in that 200 to 400% of federal poverty guidelines, that $25 copayment would be reasonable. And not something that would price them out. If someone was not able to afford a $25 copay, in general, our presumption is that might be someone that absolutely should be served by one of our public programs.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And a question for Ms. Moorhead. What would we need to do to work with Big Pharma to get insulin prices down to the level of what Canadians pay and the rest of the world?
And
brief answer, please.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, we definitely cannot collude on price for antitrust purposes as an industry or our companies among each other. But I think we do have policy solutions that we'd be happy to discuss with you, thinking about how we can improve things for different types of patients.
I'd like a meeting, right, Madam Chair, please, with you. Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chair, I just make
one. Howard, you get the last word.
Go just on that point, Madam Chair, I just make a point that the Attorney General's office is in the process of a lawsuit about price colluding with our pharma manufacturers on insulin. But just my final comment, and a little bit to interruption of Grunhagen's point. I mean, I think the necessity of having a bill like this is that I think as legislators we have a responsibility to make sure that Minnesotans aren't losing their life because they can't afford their insulin. And I think we've heard platitudes from Big Pharma, but not a lot of serious solutions. And I'm all ears if there's some significant policy solutions that we can work with them on. To date, that hasn't come to fruition. I think this bill is necessary and the right step, and I would argue that we're morally obligated to consider it and move forward this session. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Howard. So House File 485 is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. Members, before you go, two things. One, remember, put your unheard bills back into your folder. Please make sure you do that. We are going to adjourn and recess until 5:30. This room 200, so we are in recess. Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to call the committee back to order, Health and Human Services Finance Division. Representative Lesh, I'm sorry we made you wait until this evening. I just want to say to members, we have, I think I counted 11 bills that we have for this evening, and 10. Someone tells me 10. I think one of them came off the agenda. So, and I know that some of you would like to be elsewhere for a couple hours this evening,
this is exactly where I want to be, Mr. Chair.
Pardon?
This is exactly where I want to be, Mr.
Chair. Okay, this is where everyone wants to be. There is no place better than this. Anyway, maybe we can move expeditiously through some of these bills and we are going to do them all. So, Representative Lesh, welcome to the committee. The chair will move House File 4 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. Is that your understanding, Representative Lesh?
Absolutely, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you. Please go ahead and present the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is, I can't remember how many committees we've been through on this, and some folks I know have already heard major provisions of this bill, so I'll keep it brief, and I have a testifier here who's willing to speak to the importance of why we're going to pass this.
Excellent. And Representative Lesh, there is an amendment in the packet. Is that yours?
Okay. Is it our amendment?
And that's the A3?
I'm gonna hold off on that until I have someone tell me that is my amendment, Madam Chair. Just to be on the safe side. And maybe we may get there in a second. So, Madam Chair, the prohibition against charging unconscionable prices, price gouging, is pretty straightforward. First of all, it states that there are certain essential drugs that folks need to survive. One of them is probably insulin. There are several other pharmaceutical products out there that people need in order to live. This bill I first brought several years ago when Martin Shkreli, the pharma bro, was very proud of the fact that he bought up a popular drug to reduce the side effects of HIV/AIDS, and he jacked up the price of that drug 5,000%. Now, keep in mind, Mr. Shkreli, he didn't invest in any of the R&D to develop this drug. He didn't pay researchers to determine how we were going to make sure that folks survived these diseases. he didn't involve himself in any of the clinical trials. He merely took a drug that was already on the market that people could afford to make their lives better and jacked up the price to make himself rich. That's what we are looking to prevent with this legislation. It states that there are certain drugs that are essential and that the state will keep a list of those drugs that are essential. And the ones that are essential, the Attorney General can look into it to determine whether or not the increase of these prices are unconscionable. And so that's it. And there are lots of definitions within the bill, but overall it's pretty simple. It's those two pieces. There are essential drugs, and they shouldn't be, the price of them should not be unconscionably increased. And with that, I have Dawn with me, who is here to testify as to why this legislation is necessary. Oh, and also we have someone here from the Attorney General's office, I believe former Representative Moline, although I did not see her. There she is.
Yeah.
Excellent.
All right. And before we go to the testifier, Representative Hamilton, did you?
Oh, I can wait after the testifier.
Okay. Excellent. Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
You could just tell us your name and if, who you're affiliated with, if anyone, and then please go ahead.
My name is Dawn Bernfin, and I am a home care worker, and I'm also on the executive board of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. So, Madam Chair and members of the committee, like I said, my name is Dawn Bernfin. I am from Chisholm up on the range, so Carl used to be my rep. I have five kids, you know, and like I said, I'm a home care worker. And my daughter Emily, who is 20, until a few weeks ago was uninsured. And she's a shift lead at Dairy Queen and makes $12.50 an hour with no benefits. And early last spring, Emily started to not feel well, and at first she chalked it up to long hours and stress. But she didn't get any better, so she, of course, called Mom. And, you know, I told her she needed to go into the doctor because it sounded like she had a UTI, but she couldn't afford to go to the doctor because she didn't have insurance. And the free clinic in our town was only open 4 afternoons a month, and she usually has to work in the afternoons. Without seeing a doctor, she became so sick that she could barely walk, and she wound up having to go to the ER. And they said her illness was now worse than just a plain UTI. With a couple of simple drugs, she would be okay. And they gave her some meds, sent her home with some basic scripts, and to get better, she would need $375 worth of drugs. But my daughter didn't have $375, so she couldn't get the drugs. And she felt a bit better from the medicine they gave her at the ER, so she went back to work, but she got sicker. And she went back to the ER. They gave her another even more expensive prescription. And she simply couldn't afford to fill it, especially after she'd already missed some work. And the cycle repeated itself for months. And it only ended recently when she got insurance. And things are finally better, but Emily had suffered in pain for almost a year. And she could have lost her job. She could have wound up dead or lost her ability to have children. And now she's several thousand dollars in debt. And none of this had to happen. My daughter's life could have been ruined, ended, all because the drug company thought they could get away with charging $375 for a simple drug. And I want my government to stop companies from charging desperate people as much as they can. People need to be able to afford prescription drugs. Drug companies won't stop squeezing people like Emily until you give them, until you give someone the power to stop them. And that's why I urge you to vote to give the Attorney General the power to sue drug companies on behalf of all Minnesota families when they engage in price gouging. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Is there another testifier? I have
yes.
Lee Moline?
Yes, Madam Chair, if Ms. Moline could come forward.
Okay. And I should have said this at the outset, but we are going to try to keep everyone to 2 minutes or so, so we get through our 10 bills this evening. Please go ahead, Ms. Moline. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Carly Moline, and I'm here on behalf of the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General is in strong support of this bill. I just want to go through a little bit of a quick overview and then get into the fiscal note if members have questions on that portion of it. HF4 prohibits drug manufacturers and wholesale drug distributors from charging unconscionable prices for certain essential prescription drugs in Minnesota. The bill amends Minnesota Statute Section 8.31, which is the Attorney General's authority, to give us investigative and enforcement powers in that section for these matters. The Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, the Commissioner of Human Services, and health plan companies are required to report certain price increases for designated prescription drugs to the Attorney General's office. The Attorney General's office is also required to engage in a meet and confer process with drug manufacturers or distributors prior to bringing any enforcement action. This bill responds to various documented abuses in the industry that have resulted in patients not being able to access critically important medications. Essential prescription drugs are a necessity. Drug manufacturers and wholesalers are entitled to a fair return on their sale of prescription drugs in Minnesota, but price gouging regarding essential prescription drugs greatly jeopardizes public health and welfare in the state and needs to be regulated. Addressing the high cost of these drugs is one of the Attorney General's most important priorities, and this legislation is extremely helpful in dealing with the issue and protecting public interest. And, Madam Chair, do you want me to go through the fiscal note at all?
I think that would be helpful, Ms. Moline.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Our estimated costs are outlined in the fiscal note, but we're anticipating that we will need two FTEs, one attorney and one investigator to fulfill the requirements of the new investigation and enforcement provisions in this bill. And additionally, we're anticipating costs associated with having to hire experts in evaluating the clinical and economic value of pharmaceuticals so that we can access the appropriate data to assess whether or not the provisions of the bill have been violated. We also anticipate gaining certain revenues, though, under the bill, which will offset some of our costs. And those revenues are a result of our ability under current statute 8.31 to recover costs and disbursements, including costs of investigation and reasonable attorney's fees. And we can collect civil penalties up to $25,000 per violation. So we've estimated that we will recover some of the costs through that statute and offset some of the costs associated with the bill.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Moline. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier. On the points you were just talking about there, the recovery was estimated to be about 50% of the total cost. How was that 50% arrived at?
Ms. Moline, thank you, Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Schumacher. We estimated that based on our So right now we have a number of lawsuits going on against pharmaceutical companies, including about 20 against drug manufacturers just on drug pricing. Some of those are antitrust litigation. Some of them are generic drug price fixing. But we also have a number going on with the opioid epidemic and others. So we looked at settlements that we've had since from 2011 to 2008. And under that provision, 8.31 subdivision 3, where we're able to assess a $25,000 fine plus reasonable attorney's fees, from 2011 to 2018, we've collected over $18 million. And I have a list of, 10 lawsuits against pharmaceutical companies that I could get you the details on if you wanted. But the average is about $2.3 million per year.
Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so what the cost that went into it was $36 million, or I'm not, the 50%, how was that calculated in there?
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Schumacher. It's an estimate based on, of course, we don't know how many investigations or enforcement mechanisms we're going to be able to take under the new law. Because it's essentially a new and different authority than we have currently. So we're able to recoup these costs in, pre-settlement negotiations, a settlement, or through a court order. But we're just kind of estimating based on some of the current litigation we have going on, how many lawsuits we have going on, and whether or not we'd be able to assess a penalty for an actual law violation, and saying about half is just, based on our experience in other lawsuits that that would be about the number of times you would find an actual violation where you'd be able to assess the penalty.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. And members, I just want to note, too, that it's a preliminary fiscal note. And I don't know if Mr. Berg wants to speak to why it's a preliminary.
Madam Chair, members, yeah, it is a preliminary note. MMB has not signed off. I think there are still some discussion with the Attorney General's office about the nature of the costs and what should be reflected in the fiscal note. So as yet, MMB has not signed off on it.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Ms. Moline. We have some other testifiers on the list, and Tom Carlson is next, I think. Yeah, and if you could please try to keep your testimony to 2 minutes.
And at some point, Madam Chair, I would like to offer that A3 amendment.
Oh, okay. Well, should we? What's your pleasure, Chair Lesh? Do you want to let Mr. Carlson testify first?
Whichever works for you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Mr. Carlson, why don't you go ahead? Please introduce yourself for the record.
Okay. Hello, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tom Carlson, and I have lived in this wonderful state of Minnesota for my entire life. I graduated from the University of Minnesota and St. Cloud State University, getting a master's degree in education. I taught senior high school for 35 years in both Minneapolis and the Anoka Public School Districts. I retired 6 years ago, and I am currently on Medicare and Medi-Cal health insurance. I'm here today to tell you that my prescription drug copays have more than tripled from 2 years ago, and to ask you to support House File Number 4. I was diagnosed with HIV in 1995, the medication that halted the progression of the spread of this life-threatening disease came out in 1997, and I have only been on, and I have been on HIV medication since then, over 21 years. My health insurance copays have been pretty stable over the years with regular increases every year. I have been able to financially manage this until now. I am grateful for this medication, but I am confused about the continued increases that changes in its cost. In 2017, I paid $98 per month for my copay for the drug Genvoya. This has more than tripled to now $333 a month in 2019, and that's $4,000 a year, whereas before I was paying closer to $1,200 a year. In January, I had another shock when I picked up my prescription and was charged $759 for the Genvoya for the month. I realized that I am in what is called a donut hole, so I need to pay a bigger copays the first 4 months of the year, and then it gets much less. But I'm still paying $4,000 a year. It is really hard on a fixed income. Already I have canceled many activities and travels to make up for my prescriptions to the copays.
And I have to ask you to kind of wrap it up, if you would.
I will right here. Okay. Meanwhile, Medica is paying the pharmaceutical company $3,047 a month, which is $36,500 a year. That's actually $100 a pill, which is pretty weird when you're standing there holding a pill. I'm very thankful for the Medicare program that supports my health care in the A and B group programs, but we clearly need more government oversight to see to make sure that cost increases are reasonable and justified and protect the people of all ages who, like me, rely on these drugs to survive.
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson. Appreciate your testimony. Judy Cook.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Judy Cook with Cook Girard Associates, and I'm here today on behalf of the Association for Accessible Medicines, the Trade Association for Generic and Biosimilar Manufacturers. AAM is opposed to House File 4, but we do appreciate the conversations we've had with Representative Lesh about the bill. In 2017 alone, the use of generic biosimilar drugs saved Minnesotans $3.8 billion. 90% of all prescriptions are filled with generic medicines, but generics only account for 23% of the total drug spend. The state of California recently released a report on drug costs. Among their findings, it was that the generic drugs with the highest price increases accounted for less than 1% of insurance premiums. And my point in telling you all that is that we are the generic and biosimilar drugs are not the problem with high drug prices. Our concern with House File 4 is that it provides no meaningful standards that would allow companies to know whether they are compliant with the law. It prohibits unconscionable prices and defines unconscionable as not justified. Given the vague and arbitrary standards set forth in the bill, companies would perpetually be at risk of facing prosecution for taking actions that occur in the normal course of business. Further, the thresholds in the bill will capture drugs that are relatively inexpensive and not creating cost issues for the healthcare system. The bill uses an $80 wholesale acquisition cost as a floor to define an essential prescription drug. This captures a drug that costs $2.66 per day or as low as 89 cents for a medication three times a day. The bill also requires the Minnesota Board of Pharmacy, the Commissioner of Human Services, and any health plan company to notify the Attorney General of any 15% price increase in an essential drug in any one-year period. For a drug with a WAC price of $80, that would include reporting increases as low as 40 cents per day. Finally, the bill would create a private right of action. This provision would permit anyone to bring a lawsuit whenever they believe a price is unconscionable, again, using the vague terms included in the bill. Drug pricing is an extremely complex process that includes many entities within the drug supply chain, as well as a number of significant federal laws. And I want to remind you again that the generic and biosimilar industry is in a competitive marketplace.
We need you to wrap it up.
We'll do. Minnesota is home to at least three generic drug manufacturers who are small to medium-sized businesses in Baudette, Maple Grove, and New Hope. Should any of these companies be sued under the private right of action, the cost of defending their pricing, even if found appropriate, would have a significant impact and repercussions on their business. I'd also like to encourage the committee to think about all of the bills that you're working on that impact generic drugs.
You're way over the 2 minutes. I'm sorry.
Okay. And the impact.
All right.
I'll be back.
Thank you very much. Rick Barco. I see. Okay, very good. So is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on House File 4? Please come down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. Good evening. My name is Christina Moorhead, and I'm a Senior Director of State Policy for the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. PhRMA is the trade association that represents the country's leading innovative biopharmaceutical research companies that have invested more than $600 billion since 2000 in search for new life-saving and life-improving treatments and cures. And we agree, too, that for too many Americans, the healthcare system is not working, and too many patients are struggling to afford or get access to the medicines that they need, and we think that that needs to change. However, while well-intended, House File 4 does not address the issue of price gouging or what a patient pays for a prescription medicine because it's focusing on wholesale acquisition cost, or WAC. While WAC is used to determine pricing from manufacturers to wholesalers and wholesalers to pharmacies, it's typically not used by insurers or PBMs to set the reimbursement rate, and it will not account for the discounts drug manufacturers provide to payers. So focusing on WAC ignores the reality that health insurers are determining the price that a patient pays out of pocket for prescription medicine. We also have legal concerns with this bill because federal patent law preempts any provision that would interfere with the pricing of patented drugs, biologics, or devices. The District of Columbia City County Council passed a price control regulation for patented drugs in 2005 that defined what excessive prices meant. Three different courts struck down the D.C. law through a legal process that went up to the Federal Circuit Court. The legal reasons these courts struck down the D.C. price control law is because state price controls on patented prescription drugs changed the balance that Congress set in the federal law through the Hatch-Waxman Act. In closing, we appreciate and applaud the commitment of the committee to address the high out-of-pocket costs patients face when paying for their medicines. We have serious concerns with the language with this bill and also legal concerns with this as well. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. And I know Representative Hamilton has a question for you, so please stay for a moment. I'd just like to adopt the amendment before we forget to do it. So the chair will move the A3 amendment to put the bill in the form in which the author would like to have it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay, Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Moorhead, help me understand. I brought this up before, and I have the bill. My wife emailed me the recent bill. I'm on a drug for my multiple sclerosis, and for years it was priced at right around $7,500 a month. Recently it jumped to $15,000 per month. What goes into that thought process on what would drive up that increase twofold in a matter of a few days?
Ms. Moorhead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, so again, I work for the Trade Association. I don't know about how a specific drug is priced. Factors that a company can consider in raising the cost of a drug, sometimes there's manufacturing changes, sometimes there's ingredient changes. Sometimes drugs are competing against each other, and the PBMs on the formulary may require extra rebates. So again, we have the list price versus net price of the drugs that I've testified in here before, too, of the PBMs and the health insurers wanting increased discounts and rebates on that. I think a change that we've seen over time is how more patients now are covered with health plans that are no longer just copay plans. Now they may require coinsurance or deductible payment. So whereas before it didn't necessarily matter where the discounts were going because patients were paying premiums and copays, now we're seeing issues because of how insurance design has changed.
Representative Hamilton.
Well, Madam Chair, I think this is why we need transparency in the system so we can understand the whys behind this. And I want to thank Representative Lesh for bringing this bill forward as well, because there's so many examples, and I have one of them with the drug that I'm on. And so thank you for having this hearing.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Hamilton. And I just heard, and I'm going to go to Representative Munson, but sometimes it's because the PBMs want more rebates.
Right.
So we're raising the prices of the drugs to give more rebates to the PBMs.
Correct.
That's very interesting. Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lesh, thanks for bringing this bill forward. It's it's an interesting bill. It seems to me that you're authoring this bill because that this going after the pharmaceutical company is not in the scope of the Attorney General's existing responsibilities. I heard a testifier from his office talking about a new and different authority. And it kind of has me concerned. I mean, I'd like to write a bill that said we should go after unconscionable child care fraud, something that you know, is just excessive. But I think that should already be in their responsibility to go after companies that are not practicing correct standards here in Minnesota. And I'm just wondering where it will stop. Are we going to go after, can we go after the high taxes we have in Minnesota? Because a lot of people here think it's unconscionable to have to pay taxes here that are so high and egregious. I mean, where's the authority going to end high farmland costs? And when do free markets get to actually work? And I guess my specific question to you is, we just heard a bill that was going to tax the insulin manufacturers over $10 million a year. And they're offering a new generic one this month. I think it's $375. If it goes up to $432, which is about 15%, are they going to be under investigation for raising the cost of insulin again to cover the $10 million in fines that we're assessing to them? Is that a possibility that they could investigate?
Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Munson. God, I hope so. I hope they get investigated.
Perfect.
Yes, because these people that were paying $80 a month for insulin or less, or I've heard a lot less, now that they're paying over 300 or 475, you go from 300 to 475, should they be investigated just because of that, because they had to pay fines because they were gouging people already? Yeah, I absolutely think it's high time they'd be investigated. But to answer your question on the legal theory that's presented in this, I'd say every biennium or two, I bring a bill that asks the courts to recognize a specific cause of action. Now, there are a multitude of cause of actions that you could bring a case because someone got hosed, whether it's prescription drug prices or anything else. But a lot of times, courts need direction. They could, if they were going to go out on a limb,
recognize a novel cause of action under, let's say, public nuisance, the existing public nuisance law or something. However, a lot of times those suits won't survive a summary judgment motion because the judge is like, well, you know what, I'm not just not sure about this. When you spell it out for them, you spell it out for consumers to say this is actually a cause of action because there's such a great need because of the unconscionable increase of prices, it helps consumers get some measure of justice in the courts.
So thank you, Representative Lesch. I'm going to call on Representative Olson in a moment, but I just wanted to direct the committee's attention. This bill went through HHS policy, went through commerce, went through judiciary and civil law. That's Chair Lesch's committee, and now it's here. So it's really here because of the fiscal piece, and, you know, we want to allow a little bit of discussion, but, you know, the legal part of it, I think, has probably been discussed in Representative Lesch's committee. Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just a question for Representative Lesch, just given the nature of the conversation here today. We've heard that, you know, drug companies will likely raise prices because of what we do with the pharmaceutical bills that we have here. But when they received, the pharmaceutical companies, when they received a cut in the federal tax bill, did they lower the price of drugs, do you know?
Representative Lesch.
Oh, Madam Chair and Representative Olson, that's what me and the business call a softball question. No, they did not lower it. They got their tax break from the American people, and they increased drug prices on top of it.
All right. Thank you, Representative Lesch. So seeing no further discussion, the chair will lay over House File 4 as amended for possible inclusion in the HHS finance bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Let's see. Is Representative Cantrell, are you ready to go on 1257?
Always, Madam Chair.
All right. All right. Representative Cantrell is going to move that House File 1257 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. Please present your bill. Oh, and there is an amendment as well. Did you want to move the amendment before you get started here, Representative Kentrell? I don't know if that's yours or not.
Yes, please, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Representative Kentrell is going to move the A1 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which he would like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Motion prevails. Okay, to the bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. It is a pleasure to join you again. To present House File 1257. First, I want to thank the many members of our committee, Representative Hamilton, Chair Liebling, Representative Zerwas, and Representative Baker, to name just a few, for supporting this really essential bill. Currently, what the situation is, folks, let's say somebody has a chronic illness, such as multiple sclerosis, depression, epilepsy, conditions that require a unique drug or unique combination of drugs that oftentimes force the patient to go through an incredibly stressful, lengthy, and costly process of trial and error before they find the right drug or combination of drugs that actually will work for them. Currently, folks might sign up for a health plan at the beginning of the contract year because that health plan covers their unique drug that they need. The situation that we have right now is health plans can change their formulary 3 months into the contract year and remove that drug from the formulary. So somebody might have engaged in this contractual relationship solely because it covers their needs, only to find out that not only is their drug no longer covered and they're going to have to pay for it out of pocket now, but they're still on the hook for the contract. In no other contractual relationship do we allow this to continue. So, Madam Chair and members, what our bill does here is it says, look, you can still change your formulary for certain prescribed circumstances, and those are enumerated in the bill. There are several of them. But what we're not going to let you do is we're not going to let you leave patients in Minnesota high and dry, yank the rug out from under them, and force them to pay the outrageous cost of health care already, in addition to now having them go through the entire process again of trying to find a drug that works or having to pay for it out of pocket. So with that, members, I'm more than happy to yield for questions. And I do just want to quickly touch on the amendment that we adopted for clarification. So this was language that DHS suggested. It's lines 1.12 and 1.14, kind of the focus of this. For managed care plans and county-based purchasing plans, the change from beginning in the calendar year, January through December, to a single calendar quarter, is because Medicaid needs to cover all drugs whose manufacturers participate in federal Medicaid drug rebate programs. And these federal Medicaid drug rebates are published quarterly by CMS. So in the event that there's a major shift in the federal rebate or there's a discontinuation of manufacturer participation and federal funding is no longer available, DHS needs to be able the state needs to be able to orient around these changes. So that's how it differs from private health care plans, and that's why we needed to have that kind of leeway in there solely for those programs. Otherwise, I don't think that patients should be forced to pay for the exorbitant cost of health care while not having their services covered. So with that, Madam Chair, I'll yield for questions.
All right. Thank you, Representative Cantrell. And members will note that there isn't a fiscal note in the packet, and Mr. Berg is going to – there is a preliminary fiscal note that I guess just came out, and so Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, there is – again, yes, it just – MMB has not yet signed off. There is a very preliminary fiscal note that has general fund costs of $47,000 in the first biennium and $62,000 in the out years. Then it also shows, I should note, it shows a cost item in the state employee group insurance fund of about $90,000 and then $140,000. But I'll note that we don't appropriate funds for CGIP costs. It's an insurance program which is paid for by premiums that are removed from, taken out of employee salaries. So while there is a potential cost of the CGIP program, we would not appropriate those funds.
Okay. All right. So questions for members? Okay. Representative Munson, you have a question?
No.
Okay. Seeing none. So House File 1257 is laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
All right. Are we ready to? Okay. So we're gonna take next 1246, Representative Morrison. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And let's see, there are no amendments. So, right, no amendments on the bill. So,
correct.
So the chair will move House File 1246 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. And the fiscal note is being handed out. So go ahead, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. The rationale for House File 1246 is simple. The cost of prescription drugs is high and growing higher. As a percentage of the healthcare dollar, rising prescription drug prices have overtaken inpatient hospital costs with no signs of abating. New drugs coming to market have exorbitantly high launch prices. The prices of older drugs are increasing significantly. Lowering drug prices is a priority for Minnesotans. Creating more transparency of drug prices is an important first step toward raising awareness of the role of drug prices in healthcare and in helping to drive down those prices. This drug price transparency initiative is supported by a broad coalition of stakeholders. The bill is also co-authored by a large bipartisan group of legislators. The goal of the bill is to require drug manufacturers to provide greater transparency of drug prices. The proposal requires price transparency for three categories of drugs, existing drugs, new drugs, and newly acquired drugs, and establishes monetary penalties and enforcement for manufacturers who fail to comply with the reporting requirements. The bill is designed to be consistent with the other states that have enacted this legislation, which should make it easier for drug manufacturers to report, given that they're already doing so in other states. Similar drug price transparency legislation is being considered in additional states as well. There's a need to know why drugs are so expensive so that as policymakers we can drive better public policy for patients across Minnesota. This bill has strong bipartisan support and is backed by a broad coalition of organizations. It's time to address this issue. We cannot afford to wait. I urge your support of House File 1246.
All right. Thank you, Representative Morrison. I have some testifiers down here on the list. Is Don Bernfin still here? Or? Oh, I see. Rick Barco, I see. They switched.
Otherwise known as.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Chair Liebling, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rick Barco. I'm the political director of SEIU Healthcare Minnesota. I'm testifying in support of House File 1246 on behalf of our union. We represent over 35,000 workers in hospitals, clinics, nursing homes, and self-directed home care. I am sure all of you have heard from your constituents more than enough to convince you of the high cost of prescription drugs is out of control. SEIU supports this bill as an important step that a wide variety of members and groups can support. Some of you may be worried that this bill doesn't go far enough. Let me say to you that it is as strong, if not stronger, than similar bills that passed in California and Oregon. I want to emphasize the importance of the deterrence effect. When considering how much to raise their prices, drug companies will have a financial and public relations incentive to keep their increases below the thresholds established in this bill. Even if no disclosure is ever filed, the bill may have a small but significant impact on drug prices. In addition, the data collected will help answer the question that seems to keep coming up again and again in this room about whether the high cost of prescription drugs comes from necessary costs or from excessive profits. Some of you may be worried that this bill goes too far and imposes unnecessary burdens on drug companies. Let me say to you, we can debate the proper role of government regulations, but no industry has less grounds for complaint than the pharmaceutical industry. For starters, almost the entire industry is built on a government-enforced monopoly. Anybody could easily manufacture most of these drugs for far lower costs, except for the small fact that it would be illegal. Beyond that, unlike most everything else the government buys, the pharmaceutical industry has gotten laws passed that to prevent us from negotiating lower prices. With all of these advantages and privileges granted to the industry by government, it hardly seems extreme to give ourselves the right to look under the hood in cases where prices rise dramatically. Finally, while this bill won't solve the problem of high drug costs, it will show that we can begin working together to solve a problem that inflicts enormous pain on so many people. Once we take this first step, maybe we'll find it easier to work together on the next step. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Barco. Judy Cook? And then we're going to have Christina Moorhead again, so you could be ready to come down. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will stay within my time. Again, Judy Cook with Cook Girard Associates, representing the Association for Accessible Medicines. Appreciate the opportunity to discuss our concerns with Representative Morrison. AAM believes that transparency in drug pricing is important, but have concerns with some of the specifics of this bill. Believe they are misdirected by placing significant reporting burden on the generic industry, which is the segment of the healthcare market that brings competition and lower costs to Minnesotans. I won't go into all the specifics, but I'm just going to use one example because I think it does illustrate. The requirement to report new drugs does not recognize the cost savings of generics. For example, a few weeks ago, there was the launch of the first generic for Advair, the asthma inhaler. It was brought to market at a 70% discount off the brand price. This is significant savings for consumers. However, the bill would require the generic Advair to report, but the brand would not report because its price had not increased above 10%. So that does not seem appropriate and just one of our concerns with the bill. I would also like to suggest that reducing the number of drugs required to be reported should favorably impact the cost of the program, and that speaks directly to the fiscal note. I also think it will provide more useful information for the public. AEM has been clear that if there are outlier generics that do have high drug prices and significant price increases, then they should be included in a transparency reporting requirement. And again, I really would encourage you to look at all of the drug bills that you are working on, as well as other drugs, and the impact on generics. And we look forward to working with you on that and having that conversation. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Cook. Ms. Moorhead. Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Again, my name is Christina Moorhead, and I'm with the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America, or PhRMA. Again, we're the trade association representing the country's leading innovative biopharmaceutical research companies. So I mentioned previously in my testimony today, we talked a little bit about the low net list price growth due to the substantial discounts that manufacturers give to payers. And we think that this is important when you calculate the price and the cost of the drug. And that's a factor that's left out of this bill, because the metric used in this bill to measure price increases is wholesale acquisition cost, or WAC. And we talked a little bit about that with the last bill, too. So WAC is used to determine pricing for manufacturers to wholesalers and wholesalers to pharmacies, but it's typically not used by insurers or PBMs to set the reimbursement rates, and it's really not representative of what a patient pays for in medicine. So the information that you're going to get from drug manufacturers out of this bill, we think, is overly burdensome legislation, both for the state and from biopharmaceutical manufacturers at best, that results in meaningless information on prescription drug prices being reported out to the public. At worst, this legislation has the potential to scare patients into thinking that the WAC price is what they pay for a prescription medicine, and that could cause them not to fill a needed prescription out of fear that they won't be able to afford their medicine because the list price is increasing, even if that's not the price that they pay for a medicine. It may also create a gray market where secondary distributors enter the pharmaceutical supply chain, stockpiling medicine and reselling them to each other. This is because of the advanced pricing notifications. Before they're ultimately sold to a hospital or another healthcare facility. These gray markets create shortages and introduce avenues where counterfeit medicines may enter the market, and they can threaten patient safety and drive up costs. And finally, we saw similar legislation passed by California two years ago, in 2017, which is currently being litigated on the grounds that it violates the Commerce Clause, the First Amendment, and the 14th Amendment. So again, in closing, we appreciate and applaud the commitment of the committee to address the high out-of-pocket costs patients face when paying for their medicines, but believe this legislation will result in the reporting of information that does not lower patient costs, it's going to misinform patients about the price they pay for a prescription medicine, and it could create gray markets that result in price increases and safety issues.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are all the testifiers finished?
They are, but I haven't asked if there's anyone else in the room who wants to testify. Do you want to hold your question for a moment?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. Is there anyone else in the room who wants to testify on House File 1246? I'm not seeing anyone, so go ahead, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you so much for this bill, Representative Morrison. I just wanted to say that that I've done a lot of kind of research, and I did my homework in this area of why exactly are drug prices increasing and what do those increases look like. For example, Mr. Smith-Holt, who testified earlier, mentioned that his son, now deceased, God rest his soul, was on the drug Sanofi. It's an insulin drug. And the cost of Sanofi alone rose by 49% in the year 2014. We need transparency in this industry. Because, you know, personally, the argument for me that reporting why exactly we are increasing the prices of drugs, the research and development costs for which have already long been paid for, is not as overly burdensome as losing a loved one, is having your healthcare costs go up 49%. So that to me, is really where we need to be focusing our efforts. And I don't think the pharmaceutical industry is going to be happy with anything that we do, because we're trying to finally balance the scales for patients in Minnesota, and that is what your bill seeks to do, Representative and Dr. Morrison. So I wanted to thank you so much for that.
Yeah, thank you very much, Representative Cantrell. So seeing no other comments or nobody else is on the list, so Representative Bierman.
The question I had is... Oh, she left. I guess she left. Can she come back down?
Ms. Moorhead?
Yes. one of the industry. Morehead.
Yeah, and Representative Bierman, did you have a? I know we've kind of gone far afield from where we are sort of supposed to be in the committee, because we are the fiscal committee and more about the fiscal. But
Madam Chair, it's your committee, so you just tell me.
But please, yeah, if it's a short question that she can answer briefly, that would be fine. And we
I'll
have
ask,
another question.
I'll ask the short one, Madam Chair. Thank you. In the pharmaceutical industry in the United States, are there any existing price structures or restraints in place on manufacturers or pharma right now?
Ms. Pat.
Madam Chair, member, do you mind if I ask a clarifying question?
Representative, yeah, sure, go ahead.
Okay. So you're asking if there are any restrictions on prices for manufacturers currently in the United States?
Yes, exactly. Are there any restrictions when a new drug comes out? Are there any parameters on what the manufacturer may put that product out for sale in the United States, unlike other countries where they do have panels and restrictions on what drug prices can be sold for?
Ms. Moorhead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for new prescription drugs, no. For drugs in the Medicaid program, there is a CPI penalty rebate that increases as a list price of a drug increases.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gernhagen.
Oh, I'll keep my comment real brief. I just find myself, I'd encourage members to look at the federal program that's trying to address drug costs, okay? It's called Patients First, and it was in May 2018. It identifies some of the reasons costs have gone up exponentially. It also talks about reform, some of which we have mentioned here. But it tries to use market-based solutions rather than, government down approach to controlling prices. And I tend to find myself agreeing with Judy Cook and Christina Moorhead testimony, because I just see a lot of these bills as putting a lid on a boiling pot of water. And what we need to do is turn the burner down. And the way you turn the burner down is with certain reforms, and they identify PBMs and some of the negotiating and market reforms, but also increased competition. And it talks about improvement of generics. One other factor that they mentioned in the federal reform is foreign countries are putting price controls on many of the drugs, and then the drug companies are cost-shifting to drugs in the United States, where you have a more open market yet to a certain degree. So, when you try to put a lid on a boiling pot of water, negative consequences come out of that if you don't turn the burner down. And again, the way to turn the burner down is with private market reform. So I just encourage members to look at the patient first. It defines the problem and also gives solutions. And not many of these bills address solutions that are recommended in the federal approach. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Cantrell.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and just one small correction. Mr. and Mrs. Smith-Holt's son was on Lantus, which is an insulin drug made by Sanofi. Wanted to correct myself for the record. So that's all I got, Madam Chair.
Okay, Representative Morrison, I was going to give you the last word. Can I go to Representative Bierman, and then you'll get the last word?
Certainly,
okay?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A lot of what I just heard was that the prices of drugs in the United States are rising because we're paying for the research, or we're paying for the fact that they're sold cheap elsewhere, so we're supposed to pay for that. I don't think it could be further from the truth. I think the fact is that in the mid-90s, the United States decided that there would be no price restraints on the manufacture of drugs in this country. So all the world companies that made drugs came to the United States. It's a totally free market. Everywhere else, had price controls, or they run their health care systems differently, and that may be the most important part of this whole thing. If we want to get down to lower health costs, lower drug costs, the best thing to do is to rethink our health care system. I know there's reticence to do that, but can you imagine if we set out in the beginning to make our health care system and we would end up with what we have today? Nobody in this room would think that's even possible. So we need to have a restart on how we think about healthcare, and there's a lot of different factors that play into this. But just in focusing on just drug costs themselves, I mean, we can go into all the other things, technology, we can go into the system that we have where we're paying for certain things like, oh, let's say, an MRI here in the United States can range anywhere from $1,200 to $3,400. In Japan, it costs $160 with the same advanced technology, plus $45 for the radiologist to read it. So these prices, they just add up and they pile up and they pile up in our system, and we need to address it as a whole, but there's many moving parts. Drugs are one part of it, but I think this wild free market system we have on price is certainly a big part of it. Thank you.
Right. And final word, Representative Morrison.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Representative Gruenhagen, I know you've heard a lot of bills about drugs this evening, but I just want to point out that this bill, there's no price control. This is a pure reporting bill that you could make the case could increase competition and let the free market do a better job of what it's doing. But I would just add that if you listen to all of these representatives of different parts of the pharmaceutical industry try to explain why drug prices are so high, very few people can understand what is going on. And so we need to start getting better information so that we can understand why this is happening. And so I would just urge your support. Thank you for hearing the bill.
Thank you, Representative Morrison. So House File 1246 is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance omnibus bill. Thank you. Great. Go to Representative Bonner, House File 687. All right, Representative Bonner. So the chair will move House File 687 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS finance omnibus bill. And I don't see any amendments in the packet, so go ahead, Representative Bonner, and present your bill.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I want to thank you, of course, for allowing me the opportunity to come before you tonight to talk about House File 687. This bill specifically deals with med synchronization as well as emergency refills. And really quickly, in kind of a nutshell, I'll kind of describe for you what the bill does. This bill has already been heard in Commerce as well as HHS policy. So this is kind of one of its final stops here. I will tell you, I did have a testifier. Unfortunately, she was not able to stay into the evening. But if there are additional questions or specifics on the bill, we do have right behind me Executive Director Cody Weiberg from the Board of Pharmacy as well. So with that, briefly, what the bill does is it allows for one time a year to do what's called a med synchronization. And that means, so let's say, for example, that you have a prescription and your refills come due on three different days during the month. So let's say you have a refill on the 15th, one on the 20th, and one on the 30th. Essentially, what this bill will do is allow you to synchronize those prescriptions and onto a day of your choosing so that you can actually pick them up all at one time. And it also has a provision in there that allows this same synchronization to be done for folks who are parents or guardians. And specifically, that comes into play because we want that ability for folks who may be taking care of elderly and aging parents. It's much easier for seniors and young families. folks with small children. Really, we've got this healthcare system, and we somehow along the way forgot that it's designed to serve people. So the first portion of this bill does just that. It puts the folks behind this back into the equation, make their lives a little bit simpler, a little bit easier. It also eases issues of transportation and so forth for those folks, including our seniors and low-income folks. The second part of this bill is very similar to something that it ties in a little bit to what you heard earlier from Representative Howard, and that is an emergency refill. What it does is it allows for a one-time 30 days, up to, I should say, a 30-day supply of a medication when they're not able to get a hold of a physician. And this pertains specifically to drugs where you may have a life-threatening condition or something to sustain your health. So think things like a heart condition, an asthma inhaler, or a diabetes medication like insulin, for example. So making sure that folks have the ability to do that. It does have a provision within the bill that allows for us to notify a provider within 72 hours that this has happened, so that they can be aware. That also will trigger perhaps a call from a physician. But the idea here is that within that 30 days that we are able to have that patient connect with their physician and make sure that they're on the right track. There is one call out here for this does not, just to be clear, include controlled substances, with the exception of one minor item, and that is specific to a 72-hour supply. And I want to make sure I get it correct here, if I can find it for you. It's a 72-hour supply. I'm sorry. Here it is. On line 3.24, if you'd like to see it in the bill, and it says that it does not apply to controlled substances as listed in sections 152.02, subdivisions 3 and 6, except for a controlled substance that has been specifically prescribed to treat a seizure disorder, in which case they will allow for a 72-hour supply. So really, once again, I just want to clarify that really what this bill does is try to put our patients back in the driver's seat here, and make sure that they are getting what they need at the pharmacy and that our pharmacists can do right by them.
All right. Thank you, Representative Bonner. So are there any testifiers? Is there anyone in the room who'd like to testify on House File 687? Okay, not seeing anybody. Dr. Weiber, come on up. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Cody Weiberg, the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. Just really wanted to say two things. First of all, the board fully supports this legislation. It actually, a version of this was in our policy bill. We actually amended it out when we realized Representative Bonner's bill was going forward. The other thing I wanted to mention is I was over in Senator Benson's committee before here. Senator Wicklund successfully got this language amended to Senator Rosen's drug price transparency bill, so I just wanted to let you know that.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Weiberg. Okay, Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, Representative Bonner. Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. I actually kind of like this bill. I want to be positive. Okay. I oppose the gag rule on the pharmacy. I support getting rid of that, and I think this is a good idea. I trust our pharmacists, especially with they fill prescriptions every day. I think they're professionals that can be trusted to make these types of decisions. So, I just want to comment, we haven't had a free market in healthcare since about 1965, tell you the truth. So just encourage people to read my book, and you'll find out what a lot of the problems are, okay?
All right. I don't know if there's a reverse advertising.
I didn't say I was going to charge for it.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Representative Grunhagen, for the support.
All right. All right. Thank you. Representative Baker.
Okay.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I had a question for Dr. Weiberg, and I wasn't going to ask it until I saw you come up. I get a little nervous when I do see the controlled substance and the 72-hour thing with the seizures. Would you just make sure that tell me and the committee here what medicine that is that would be that would take some worry off of my mind?
Dr. Weiberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Baker, I'm not sure that there are a lot of controlled substances used for seizures anymore. However, there is a slim possibility that someone might still be on a drug called phenobarbital, pretty much been replaced by other medications, but at least back the last time I practiced, which I have to admit was over a dozen years ago, there were a few people on it. Occasionally, benzodiazepine drugs like Valium are sometimes used for seizures. So I just wanted to make sure that in case there is somebody that still is on a medication like that, that they would be able to get up to a 72-hour supply. Opiates are not used for seizures, not that I'm aware of. But in, like I said, I think it's fairly rare, but just in case.
You read my mind. Thank you.
Yep. All right. Thank you. Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering about the fiscal note for this bill.
Representative Schumacher, on this one, there is no fiscal note. It's free.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm so glad you asked. Thank you. I just love to be able to say that.
That is great news, Madam Chair. Is the intent still to lay this over then or to move it on to Ways and Means?
Yeah, this one, the intent is to lay it over. That's the motion on this one. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so seeing no other further questions, this House File 687 is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you, Representative Bonner.
Thank you.
So the next one will be Representative Akam, House File 815. Welcome to the committee. Representative Akam is going to move that House File 815 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Finance Omnibus Bill. And I don't see any amendments. There is a fiscal note in our packets. And Representative Akam, go ahead, please, and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Thank you for giving us the opportunity to present Bill, our House File 815. I am joined today by Dan Anderson with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. House File 815 applies step therapy override procedures to state public health care programs. To provide a little background to my bill, step therapy protocols, sometimes referred to as fail first, require patients to first try and fail at least one medication chosen by a health plan before the health plan will cover the medication that was originally prescribed by the provider. For those living with a serious chronic illness, prolonging ineffective treatment and delaying access to the right medication may result in possible disease progression, loss of function, and adverse effects. As a spouse of a person living with MS, I know firsthand the challenges of daily life, and adding on to those challenges, the reality of wasting time on ineffective treatments is real. My husband experienced irreversible treatment progression while waiting to fail on ineffective medications. For those of you who are on this committee, last year, this bill may seem familiar. Last year's bill was House File 3196, provided an override process to step therapy for those on private insurance. My bill adds this benefit to those on public insurance programs such as Minnesota Care and Medical Assistance, ensuring equal protections for lower-income patients. DHS has reviewed the bill and added some technical changes to align the bill with state's prescription drug formulary process. Mr. Anderson was involved in the passage of the original bill, and I'd like to give him an opportunity to provide some additional information to the committee.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Dan Anderson with the National Multiple Sclerosis Society. The society, along with several patient and provider groups, which are listed on the letter in your packets, support House File 815, and we thank Representative Akam for bringing this bill forward. She mentioned the law that's currently in place, which went into effect January 1st. So this allows providers to request an override of a step therapy requirement if their patient satisfies one of three situations. They'd have an adverse reaction or be harmed by taking a preferred medication. If that individual has tried and failed on a similar medication, or if that individual has been changing insurance companies and they're maintaining stability on that existing medication. So just to be clear, that law doesn't ban the use of step therapy. It doesn't mandate coverage. It just allows the provider to make this request. Last year, it didn't include the public programs. DHS was going through their process of creating a single formulary across public programs. And so now that process is further along, we wanted to ensure that that formulary has step therapy protections, because currently the situation is we have folks who are in the private marketplace having those protections, and right now those who are on medical assistance, Minnesota Care, do not. As indicated by the fiscal note, sometimes often the assumption will be that step therapy saves money. However, it doesn't account for the actual costs of going through a step therapy process, such as continual tests, as well as maybe worsening of a disease. We have some information that I can provide to the committee that shows that there has been an increase in cost in other states. For example, Georgia started using step therapy for drugs to treat schizophrenia. Initially, that Medicaid program saved $19.62 per person per month. Subsequently, the state ended up spending $31.59 per month, a net increase of $11.97 per person, mainly because those individuals were taking ineffective medication or maybe not taking them at all, and then facing either hospitalization or other further medical issues. And so what we're asking for is that all Minnesotans be covered under that are currently being regulated by state-regulated health plans, be treated the same, and be given the same amount of protections. Thank you.
All right. Are there any other there are no other testifiers listed. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 815? All right. I'm not seeing any. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Acom. Thanks for bringing this forward. It seems like the medical assistance program and the public programs actually serve the most medically fragile and sick people. Many times they're people who've had to give up their employment due to their increasing health care needs. And so it seems strange that this is a program that we would say should be exempt from using what works for people. And I did note in the fiscal note that it appears that it's just the drug costs that are of 103 incidences that are noted here. And if we can get some clarification from DHS in the future on whether or not they weighed in what the testifier talked about and Representative Acom about, you know, additional testing, additional appointments when things don't work. I didn't see that kind of level of sophistication in the fiscal note. Maybe we could ask them to look again.
Yeah, Representative Loeffler, I mean, it's a good point. We often struggle with this, right, that fiscal note doesn't, you know, has boundaries that we never cross, even though we know that there are other impacts out there. And so, you know, as was said, I think it may very well be that it would save money to let people stay on the drug that works for them, of course. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Loeffler. That is right down the path that I was heading. Just last week we had a dairy farmer up here and had an employee who was not able to continue on with her treatment, and she has multiple sclerosis as well and was forced to do something different. And he was telling me the story. It actually took place about a month. She has missed work now, and he was just sharing that with me. And so that was mine. What percent fail on step therapy, and what's the true cost of those failures?
Thank you, Representative Hamilton.
I like this bill.
Okay, Representative Grunhagen likes it.
Yay!
Let's
go home.
Okay. Well, you can now. No, don't go. So House File 815 is laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Finance Omnibus Bill. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
But don't go home, please. Okay. So let's see, what did he say next? We were going to take up Representative Tabke. We're going to take up House File 733.
Thank you.
And the chair will move House File 733 to be laid. This is going to be laid over too, right? To be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Finance Omnibus Bill. And I see that there is an amendment in the packet. Is that your amendment, Representative Tapke?
Do you yes, want to Madam move Chair. That now?
So the chair will move House File. Or sorry, the chair will move the A1 amendment to put the bill in the shape in which the author would like to discuss it. All those in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. The motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. So go ahead, Representative Tapke.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. Today we have before us House File 733. I have with me the warden from the Shakopee Women's Prison, Warden Tracy Belt. And 733 is an initiative from the Minnesota Sheriff's Association and the Department of Corrections to authorize the use of low-dose X-ray body scanning devices for the purpose of scanning incoming inmates to correctional facilities for concealed weapons, drugs, communication devices, and other contraband that pose serious risks to the safety and security of the jail staff and inmates. So the last year the House passed similar language and was included in the omnibus bill that was vetoed, and now we are asking to put this forward again. So the Minnesota Department of Health regulates X-ray devices used in the state of Minnesota, and current law appears to limit the use of these scanners to medical settings. And so what we need is your authorization to be able to use these body scanners in our prisons and sheriff's departments and across the state of Minnesota. So that is what we are here to discuss today, and I appreciate everyone's time.
All right. Thank you very much. And you, and Ms. Belts, did you want to speak as well?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee, thank you for allowing me this opportunity. I'm Tracy Belts. I work at the Shakopee Correctional Facility. We believe body scanners in our department would greatly assist us in detecting contraband that comes into the facilities. We have had issues as recent as a few weeks ago where we have individuals that are either smuggling it in inside themselves or on themselves, and it is extraordinarily difficult to detect. Paramount to us being able to provide programming, which we believe very strongly in, you know, our mission is to reduce recidivism. Programming is paramount, but foundationally, we have got to operate safe, secure facilities in order for women and men to be in a place where they can do programming. Drugs coming in pose a risk to the women, to the men, to the officers and other staff that work there. This, having a scanner would allow us to detect things and prevent things from coming in. If we know they are on a person, we can get them medical assistance. Right now, we don't know. The other thing with the women specifically is they suffer great history of trauma and abuse issues. Body scanner, my understanding is they wouldn't have to go through an unclothed body search. They could wear a gown on them, go through the scanner, and we'd be able to detect maybe what is on them or in them. There is also women right now that will not go to pro-social activities that we know for a fact reduce recidivism, such as visiting, because they don't want to go through the process of going through an unclothed body search. So this may actually help us increase those level of services and the women's desire to go to them. The other piece is that it's a significant win for staff. It is not a pleasant experience to have to perform an unclothed body search on somebody. So this is a win for the offenders. It's the win for the staff. And again, just very briefly, my captain of security sent me in information. This is not unheard of in other states. There was a recent article in Associated Press, the Washington County, Washington State of Virginia has a jail that's using these security measures to detect contraband. And there was an article that was written talking about when the scanners were installed, 32 inmates previously hospitalized for substance abuse. In 2017, cost the taxpayers $1.5 million. So if we can prevent this stuff from coming in and prevent people from overdosing on it, it saves the taxpayers money as well.
All right. Thank you very much. Question from Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would this be similar to an airport scanner?
Representative Tapke or or
Yes, it's the same concept. They won't look the same and they won't work exactly the same, but it's the same concept as an airport scanner, yes. And we have members from the Department of Health here who can answer questions in better detail than I can if you would like more detail as to where this goes.
No, yeah. My only comment to that is we can use them at the airports, but we can't, at the prison. So it doesn't. I support the bill. Is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, thank you.
Yay! I can go home too.
Oh well, not yet though. Please, Representative Munson.
Yep. Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question, and I know it's on policy part of this, but the. On page 2, section, or line 2.2, it says for screening of humans who are in the custody of correctional or detention facility, is the intent to also scan visitors? And is that not included in this, or should it be?
Warden Belts?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. Right now, we are just focusing on the offender population.
Okay.
All right. All right. Well, thank you very much for coming. And we do apologize that we made you come on another day and then made you come back again. So this time you really can go home. So House File 733 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Finance Omnibus Bill. So thank you very much, Representative Tapke, and thank you, Warden Bell.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Members.
All right. We are... Representative Cantrell, are you ready to do 2009?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay. House File 2009.
Or rather, I will be in just a moment, Madam Chair.
Okay, so in the meantime, Representative Cantrell moves House File 2009 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. And there is an amendment. There's an A2-1 amendment. And was that yours, Representative Cantrell?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Okay, so Representative Cantrell is going to move the A2-1 amendment to put the bill in the form in which he'd like to discuss it. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion prevails. To your bill as amended.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. It's a pleasure to join you yet again. I am presenting before you House File 2009. This is a bill that prohibits the mandated use of step therapy for patients who are going through stage 4 metastatic cancer treatment. In previous committees, but I don't believe this letter was furnished to this committee, the Susan G. Komen Foundation furnished us with a letter of support for this bill. I'm grateful to the bipartisan authors of this bill. If somebody is going through stage 4 metastatic cancer treatment, they really don't have the luxury of having to go through the override process and protocol that's currently enshrined in Chapter 162 of 2018 session law, because that's more of a may rather than a shall. And this bill is a bill that might give folks and their doctors a little bit more leeway in determining what their treatment's going to look like and what people have available to them as options as they're battling potentially fatal illness. So with that, Madam Chair, members, I'll yield for questions.
Right. So you don't have any testifiers, Representative Cantrell. Is there anyone in the room who wants to testify on House File 2009? Okay, I'm not seeing anybody. And are there member questions? Representative Schumacher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question on the fiscal note.
Yes, Representative Schumacher, I'm told by Mr. Berg that there is a preliminary fiscal note that shows a zero.
Actually, Madam Chair, I checked again, and it's signed off. It's a final fiscal note.
And it became final while we were sitting here. Mm. So there is a zero fiscal note on this bill, and I assume that will be available.
Okay, and Madam Chair, the intent is still to lay this one over?
Yes, the intent is, I think so.
Madam Chair, if it would be possible to refer to the General Register if you're amenable to that.
Ms. Niedernhofer reminds me, we can't do that. It has to. We can send it to Ways and Means, and then Ways and Means can send it to the floor. Should we amend our motion to do that?
Yes, Madam Chair, that would be most appreciated. My apologies for not catching that initially.
Okay. All right. So let's see. What do I have to do that? So I think we need a motion to amend the original motion to send the bill to Ways and Means. Am I right? Okay. So my motion. So Representative Cantrell moves to amend the motion to re-refer the bill to Ways and Means. Did I get it right? Okay.
Wait, I do have an amendment, Madam Chair.
All right. So I got that right. As amended. Right. Okay. So I can just. Okay. So thank you. So Representative Cantrell moves that House Bill 2009 be recommended to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. As amended. Sorry. 2009 as amended. Okay. Is there any discussion? All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. It is on its way to Ways and Means.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I really appreciate it.
Cantrell. So one bill got out of here alive.
Tell me there's a chance.
All right. Joaquin. Representative Joaquin. House File 62. And Representative Joaquin is going to move that House File 62. I'm sorry. The chair will move that House File 62 be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus, in the HHS finance omnibus bill. And I don't see any amendments, Representative Joaquin. And I also don't see it. But why don't we start discussing the bill, and we'll see if one appears during the while you're talking. Never know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too looked for a fiscal note online to make sure I could see one and didn't see one. But I want to thank you for being flexible. I've been stuck in the snow days conference committee and have to go back, so that's been fascinating. But it sounds like you're having fun here too. So I will continue because I know you have a tight schedule. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. The bill before you will give grants to eligible nonprofit organizations and counties to provide access to crisis services across the state and educate communities on how to access local resources and suicide lifelines. These grants must be used to provide a way to triage calls and provide immediate access to suicide prevention and crisis counseling over the phone. Grants must also be used to connect callers with trained crisis counselors and local resources, including referrals to community mental health options and emergency departments. Callers will be given options and supports in their own community. That's very important. They will be speaking to trained professionals with understanding of the areas who know the resources, the accessibility problems, and the other nuances of the community. This is especially important in Greater Minnesota, where access to mental health services is limited. Statistics in Minnesota show why this service is so desperately needed. According to DHS, suicides in 2017, there were 406 in the 7-county metro area and 377 in Greater Minnesota. Suicide is the 8th leading cause of death in Minnesota, and the 2nd leading cause of death to Minnesotans ages 10 to 24. Since 1999, Minnesota has experienced a 40% increase in suicide deaths. I have Sue Abner Holden, the Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota, here to give a brief overview of how the services in Minnesota are funded and why this grant is so important.
All right. Thank you, Representative Joaquin. And just for members, we don't actually need a fiscal note on this bill because it has an appropriation, which is on the reverse side of the bill. So welcome to the committee, Ms. Abner Holden.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, Sue Abner Holden, Executive Director of NAMI Minnesota. So the National Suicide Lifeline receives about 66,000 calls from Minnesotans. We used to have one call center in Minnesota that closed down last year, and we now use the national text line. The problem is that as part of our federal funding, we need to have call centers in Minnesota, but it doesn't have to be one place. And so we want to build on, we have actually 42 crisis numbers in Minnesota for various counties connected to the crisis teams. And so they can actually take over some of the calls that are coming in. They don't have to be necessarily 24/7. But we need to have those in order to, frankly, use the national lifeline and things like that. The other part that's really important is that they have to be certified. So they can't just say, oh, yeah, we're going to put someone next to the phone and do it. There's actually a certification process that the lifelines would have to go through. I will say that while it is not listed necessarily with anything around it in the MMB, I'm now forgetting the name, but the one that you like so much.
Results first.
Yes, thank you. It's been a long day. but there is a lot of research that has been done that has shown that we do actually reduce suicides when someone actually makes that phone call, and so it really is important that we have a place for people to call. And I will say this was also included in the governor's budget, recognizing that we need to have, call centers in Minnesota.
Okay. Thank you, Ms. Abderholden. Is there anyone else who wants to testify on House File 62? Okay, not seeing anyone. The room is kind of thinning out here, too. So are there questions? Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have a question for the testifiers. Is there money being appropriated for, by the way, this is a really great program. Is there money being appropriated for also like text message response for suicide prevention? I think a lot of teenagers, especially younger adults, people without minutes on their phone or whatever, would appreciate text messaging and social media outreach or something. Is that included?
Ms. Abderholden.
Madam Chair, Representative, we actually didn't need to use state funding for a text line anymore because the national line is free. And so any of us can text Minnesota or MN or home to 741-741. I think that I got remembered that right, and be answered. And so that is being promoted through all the current mobile crisis teams, through some of the schools and things like that.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions from members? All right. Not seeing any, so thank you. With that, House File 62 will be laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. I'm going to get that name down before we're done. I swear.
Thank you so much, Madam Chair and members.
Okay. I think that we were going to hear Representative Dabney's bill next, but I don't see Representative Dabney here, so why don't we? I think we have Representative Baker and. Why don't we take up House File 1718? Welcome to the committee. And Representative Baker is going to move that House File 1718 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. And there are no amendments that I see in the packet. Representative Baker?
Correct, Madam Chair. And to Madam Chair and the members, this could be pretty quick. I believe there is virtually no fiscal cost to this. This is a technical bill that cleans up a lot of the pharmaceutical language that Dr. Weiberg has been working on. And over the last couple of years has actually kind of been delaying kind of getting some language cleaned up. The one thing that was a little bit controversial was the compounding efforts that he kind of took most of that out of this bill. The only part of the compounding in this, I'm trying to do as much as I can for you just to save your voice, okay, and to get us out a little quicker. So it's just the compounding with the veterinarians that I've learned, too, is that they need to have this still in this bill so that when they're on site with large animals, they need to be able to actually produce the right kind of medicine for these animals of different sizes and shapes and so on. So that's part of it. But again, I think we'll just have them go through it really quickly and really kind of stand for questions, and we'll handle it that way. I know we're over to one time.
Thank you, Representative Baker. Dr. Weiberg, welcome back.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Dr. Cody Weiberg, the Executive Director of the Board of Pharmacy. Although this bill might look huge, actually about 50% of the language deals with drug wholesaling. Several years ago, Congress passed a major piece of legislation, and among other things, they dealt with compounding, but they also dealt with drug wholesaling. And what they did was they changed the national standards for licensing drug wholesalers, and they preempted all state laws. So that almost 50% of the language is just that. As Representative Baker mentioned, the veterinarians actually want the compounding language that's in here because it allows pharmacies to compound drugs for office use, which otherwise right now is not permitted. That allows them to treat anywhere from a 2-pound teacup chihuahua to a 120-pound Great Dane, which they tell me they can't do because there aren't enough commercially available products. The one other, I think, major new policy piece in here is really an amendment to a section that's been on the books for quite some time that allows for pharmacies to sell up to 10 syringes, no questions asked, to somebody who comes into the pharmacy. And the purpose of doing that is to prevent the spread of communicable diseases. And I've worked with the Department of Health on that language. Other than that, most of what else is in there are just some technical changes. And as far as I know, there's nothing controversial. To get it to make sure it was heard, the Sharon made committee deadlines. We had an author's amendment in the last committee that took out anything that I thought could be remotely controversial or anything that would be duplicative of language like the language in Representative Bonner's bill.
Ah, okay. Okay. Are there questions from members? Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House File 1718? All right, not seeing any. And Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just say Dr. Weiberg has done a lot on every bill that we've probably had in front of the committee today, and I appreciate that we're taking the time to hear this bill, and because he really has done a lot as we've tackled a lot of these big bills. So thank you.
Right. Thank you, Representative Olson. We're not done with him either. I mean, today maybe we are, but afterwards, he knows that there's more to come, right, more fun. All right. So with that, House File 1718 is laid over for possible inclusion in the House of Health and Human Services Finance Omnibus Bill. Thank you very much. And so this one's the one we're going to take. Okay. Representative Dabney, House File 2171. Representative Dabney, you have the pleasure of standing between members and adjournment. Take that however you want.
If we could just quickly call for a positive vote, I'm done. Madam Chair, thank you.
So, all right. So, Representative Dabney, this is a bill that the intention is to lay this over. Am I right? Okay.
Yes.
So, Representative, the chair will move that House File 2171 be laid over for possible inclusion in the HHS Omnibus Finance Bill. So there aren't any amendments that I see, so welcome, and go ahead and present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and I will endeavor to be brief, even though you all know that is not my strong suit. But Madam Chair, I want to thank you for being willing to break through some silos here. Minnesota has a lot of great strengths. We do a lot of things well, and we do a handful of things poorly. But one of the things we do best is admire the problems and sit within our silos. And House File 2171 asks the Department of Health to be the lead agency on looking at two places where we don't do well: health disparities and educational attainment, and the achievement gap, as we often call it, and look to see where those two often measured, identified, and talked about separate things in fact overlap. I will let me pass along to, if I may, Madam Chair, to some folks who know the situation better than I do, and I will let them arm wrestle over who goes first. Ms. Hedlund, Shauna Hedlund from Minnesota Cares.
Okay, welcome to the committee. Please say your name and your affiliation, and go ahead.
Sure. My name is Shauna Hedlund. I'm with Minnesota Community Care, a federally qualified health care center. And thank you, Chair Liebling and committee, for having us here today.
I'm also here representing the Minnesota School-Based Health Center Alliance, which allies leadership from all school-based health clinic programs in the state of Minnesota. I'm the director of school-age wellness. Oh, sorry, we already went over that. We have proudly provided, as Minnesota Community Care, holistic health care inside of St. Paul schools for nearly 50 years. School-based health centers started here in Minnesota in the 1970s as a disruption to systemic disparities in health care that were gouging opportunities after recent advancements in civil rights. This unique model of care teaches youth how to engage in their own health care, addresses trauma, reduces barriers to unmet medical needs, and simplifies access to mental health support. For those of us who see this care in practice every day, we have absolutely no doubt that addressing health disparities makes equitable engagement in school possible. I'd like to share a story of one of our patients. Jacqueline was behind in school, disengaged, and struggling with truancy. Her school social worker referred her to one of our mental health therapists, and as she went on with her visits, she began to reveal an early exposure to violence and health concerns such as a history of asthma, menstrual cramps, and acne, all keeping her from wanting to go to school. The therapist also referred her to our nurse practitioner, and after identifying precursors for diabetes, she was again referred to our registered dietitian. Jacqueline's attendance issues began changing as she got to know her new, healthier self. And a year later, this young woman has been released from the truancy program. She's passing her classes, and she's talking about post-secondary options after high school. At school-based health centers, no child is turned away and families are not charged for care. Without leaning on general education funds, we address acute and chronic healthcare needs from optometry and dental care to asthma management and trauma-informed mental health care. And research shows that addressing health in schools improves attendance, engagement, behavior, and school climate. This is one of the key strategies to disrupt gaps in healthcare and education with dramatic room for growth and expansion. Minnesota is well known for our gaps in educational opportunity and health outcomes for our communities of color and American Indians. When considering the cost of this effort, please also consider the financial burden we are currently experiencing by not effectively addressing ongoing disparities. House File 2171 presents a critical opportunity to work together to finally address these deeply rooted shortcomings in how we support our kids. We appreciate the thoughtful inclusion in this work group of a diversity of educators, community members, and healthcare providers, all key intermediaries in lifelong community-driven health and well-being. Please accept our support of House File 2171. And just to go off script for a second, I visited my father who lives in the veterans home due to Alzheimer's on the way over here. And he's a retired psychiatrist. He worked for 53 years with Lutheran Social Services. And every time I leave there, he says, well, take me home. Or can I go with you? Or where are you going? And tonight I said, I'm going to talk to the House of Representatives. And I told him about the bill. And all he said was, oh, you should go do that. That's important.
Oh. That's nice. Thank you.
Thank you for sharing that.
Welcome to the committee, and just please tell us.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. I thought you wanted to respond to her.
No, ma'am. Just tell us your name, and then go ahead, please.
Yes, ma'am. For the record, my name is Jatan White. I am a consultant and manager at the Northside Achievement Zone for our community wellness team. I thank you, Madam Chair, and representatives, and especially Representative Dabney, for this very important bill, which I also endorse, and so does the Northside Achievement Zone. To best describe the work that I do to interrupt those painful patterns that you just discussed, I will tell a story also. With my work at the Northside Achievement Zone, one of our partner schools called us in last December 2017. And when we got there, what we discovered was it was a building full of stressed kids and stressed adults. The adults had several counselors, teachers, parents, had poor kids, had actually literally walked out on these kids in this building. And so the principal was basically pulling her hair out and asking for some support. We discovered that the toxicity levels in the adults were keeping the kids from actually being actually active learning. And just to keep this brief, because I heard you earlier, I want to say that we have 100% commitment from the staff to return for the 2019-20 school year, and they're fired up with the belief that every child has the ability to learn and will learn so long as they have the support of adults. Thank you.
right. Thank you very much. I'm going to just ask Mr. Berg to discuss the fiscal note for a second.
Madam Chair, the fiscal note is not completed. There are two agencies on it, the Health Department and the Education Department. Health is in the lead on running this. They've completed their section. They have a $143,000 one-time cost. The Department of Education hasn't responded yet to the fiscal note.
Okay. I wanted Chair Dabney to hear that. Department of Education hasn't responded yet.
Duly noted, okay. Madam Chair.
Okay, we're ahead of you. We're ahead of you, Chair Dabney. So, all right. Well, we will expect to get that soon. You know, obviously, we'll need it very soon. We're on a kind of an accelerated pace here.
Understood.
But, thank you very much. So, House File, and I'm not seeing any questions. So, House File 2171 is laid over for possible inclusion in the Health and Human Services Omnibus Finance Bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you very much. So, members, that will conclude our agenda for this evening. I just really want to thank everyone for sticking around and for your cooperation and getting us through. This is really challenging. It's hard to sit for so many hours. We've had great questions, good discussions, and even though we're trying to move things pretty quickly. So I appreciate that very much. Did you want to say something, Representative Hamilton? You look like you do.
Well, I'd just say we should take all the bills today and make one omnibus bill just out of this committee hearing today. It's fantastic. Take that one all the way to the governor's desk.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Hamilton. So thank you, members. With that, we are adjourned.